Tonight on The Down Low, from Comedy Central's The Opposition, Jordan Klepper. The author of Ali, A Life, Jonathan Eig. And legendary K Records founder Calvin Johnson. Now, here's your host, a man who isn't sold on the new Aquaman, Justin Kaufman.
Call me old fashioned, but what happened to the orange top and the green pants? And also, the new Aquaman from the Justice League movie, he's got long hair and a beard. Last I checked, you can't swim with long hair. It slows you down. I thought he's supposed to be fast. He better answer all these questions in the movie this weekend. Otherwise, I'm not certain that I can buy a movie that doesn't pay homage to the original, especially with the, because I thought the idea was his green pants, hey, were almost like fins. He had
the original was Vinny Chase, right?
Right, Vinny Chase. But I don't know. Like, I just feel like there's something. I mean, the idea of hunking him out, which is great. He's all hunked out. He looks good. He's got muscles everywhere. And he looks like a badass. I mean, he's killing things in the air. And I just saw the trailers all over the TV this weekend. But there's also another to be like, this guy's got long hair, a beard. It just seems like that would slow you down if you were a creature of the sea. You don't see too many creatures of the sea with long, flowing hair.
You watch the Olympics, they don't have hipster beards.
Michael Phelps is not sporting a Jesus look.
No.
You got to keep it high and tight. There's aerodynamics at play. How can you ride on the back of a dolphin? Your hair's going to get caught up in there. There's a lot going on. I don't like it. It's a download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up tonight, we got a great show with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Rob Martier is paying attention to Senate candidate Roy Moore's possible speech. She's at a church in Alabama right now. Roe was kind of teasing it out, and I know that ABC has a coverage. He's supposed to get on the podium soon, and if he does, and he actually does give information about whether or not he's going to continue his campaign, we will cover that live. Rob's all over it. In the meantime, coming up, the download in Chicago Business at 8 o'clock. We're going to talk with Jonathan Eig, the author of Ali, A Life. Tremendous book. The first full life biography of Muhammad Ali. Surprising that it's never been done before. There have been plenty of books that have been done about Muhammad Ali, but they're always specific about the rumble in the jungle or about his early days or his late days, but nothing where it's definitive his entire life. And Jonathan Eig has done that. It's a tremendous, tremendous book, and he's my guest at the big table. Coming up a little later, Jordan Klepper, from the stages of I.O. to the stages of Comedy Central, the Chicagoan, spent years here doing bits at I.O. Second City, is now a mainstay with his daily show, his weekly show, which is right after Daily Show every night, starting at 10:30. He'll be on the show tonight. We'll talk about his career and the opposition in Comedy Central. And also Calvin Johnson is going to join us from Olympia, Washington, talk about the early days of the beginning of indie rock. Really, he was there. Talk about the West Coast influence. Right before grunge. Don't tell Calvin Johnson, hey, K Records, that was grunge, right? That's not what you want to do. So we'll talk with him about the early days of the Northwest indie rock movement. And we'll play the worst tonight. TJ Jagodowski and Abby McEnany back in studio. We got a great show. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmerella Leon. Production provided by my man, Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. Like we said, Rob's watching Roy Moore. If anything happens, we'll let you know. But we'll take a break, and we come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, it's a download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's carry out. All right, here's today's top stories. The Senate's moving tax reform along, but one of the big drawbacks is that it costs too much. And if they can't get the budget to line up properly, then by rule, they'll have to get 60 votes, which includes Democrats, to pass it back to the House. So what are they doing about that? Well, they're killing 18 birds with one stone. They're reportedly ending the healthcare individual mandate. Obviously, Republicans tried to repeal and replace healthcare twice now to no avail, but they're using tax reform as a cover to go at it for a third time. And frankly, if they remove the mandate, this would give them more revenue to balance the books. But this is always my issue with Congress. This is a bill about simplifying the tax code and cutting said taxes. But so far, Congress allegedly wants to take on other issues, health care and abortion. Yep, somehow abortion is part of tax cut now. Because when they do stuff at face value, it usually fails. So instead of trying to create more balanced bipartisan legislation, they just get all sneaky. Again, there should be a law against sneaking other issues into bills. But then again, they just sneak other issues into that bill. So what can you do? Attorney General Jeff Sessions testified in front of Congress again today, this time to answer questions about whether or not he lied the last time he was there. And the answers were a variation of, I can't recall, and I don't remember, and Hillary and uranium. As a matter of fact, it looks like the Justice Department is going to investigate the former Secretary of State for a Russian deal for a Canadian uranium company that gave donations to the Clinton Foundation, allegedly. I finally looked at this story more closely. There's a lot of holes, including that the guy who gave money to the foundation, the Clinton Foundation, he didn't own the company anymore. But, you know, details. The bigger question is, distractions aside, I'm a little skittish about the Justice Department investigating political rivals, especially when the political rival in question lost the election. It sounds like Ukraine politics to me, just short of poisoning one's soup, right? I don't like it. And if you're anti-Hillary, you shouldn't like it either. Because if you're pro-Trump, you're probably going to be in the same predicament when President Oprah gets her Justice Department to do something about it. Think about it. Here's an uplifting story from the State House. The Secretary of State's office says, we have the money for Christmas lights around the rotunda. Yay! Can I sneak in the negative now? Can I just sneak that right in? I guess the state owes over $5.5 million to City Water, Light, and Power. That's the companies down in Springfield. It's been over 60 days due. So remember that, listeners, when the energy company threatens to kill the lights for you being $80 in the hole, at least it's not multi-millions, right? I mean, I don't know. Is it payday loan time, maybe? I don't know. What do you do here? Call grandma? Check under the couch cushions? Wait, are we the couch cushions? Good gravy. We suck at paying bills, Illinois. Pay the bills. That's what you're hired to do. And now it's time for the Download's Chromium Report. Well, it's been 5 months and 28 days since the last toxic dump of chromium into Lake Michigan. So I think we're on point. This just in. U.S. Steel announced they dumped more of the toxic metal into the lake, and documents show that they wanted state environmental regulators to cover it up. Great. So I guess the calendar goes back to one. But hey, bright side, tangy tap water. Something to think about. And that's been the Download's Chromium Report. The mayor's all excited because 2017 supposedly had the most building cranes in operation in Chicago history. I mean, to be fair, half of them are being used for Chicago fire shoots. That crane's going to fall, Lady Gaga's ex-boyfriend, help! I don't know any of the characters, that's all I know. In weather, scientists are warning us that we're at a, quote, last chance to save the planet. Oh, and also it's going to be 55 tomorrow. Both those things. In sports, 1-2, take on each other at the United Center in what has become a tradition now. Michigan State versus Duke underway at half. Also, Kansas plays Kentucky. How does that happen so early in the season? You got to love Moxie, the four powerhouses, right? Most schools are playing community colleges at this point, just trying to desperately get to 8-0 so we can be like, wow, what's up with the Illini? They're undefeated. They end up still being 17-12. The big games take over the UC, and today Kentucky had a shoot-around, and that meant that the Blackhawks were bumped from practice. Seriously, like high school. Hey, coach, we reserved the stadium for this time. Can your boys wrap it up? The Hawks had to go find another ice rink to practice on. And no complaints either. I love the Hawks. The Hawks are the best. New BCS playoff rankings are out later tonight, and I'll go out on a limb and say Notre Dame is long gone. The football gods were real. I would even bounce them out of the top 25. Last week, they were the number 3 team in the country, and then they positively laid an egg. Got trounced by Miami, 41-8. Notre Dame has a way of doing that to us, don't they? They get in these big games that will determine whether or not they're contenders or pretenders, and they just get blown up. Alabama. But I guess good run for the Irish. Northwestern moves up, I'm sure, with a win over Purdue. The Bears, you know, I haven't checked anything. Have we checked? Let me check. Yeah, John Fox still the head coach? Yeah. Okay, moving on. Nothing to see here. Also, the Bulls, Chicago's Fight Club, back in action tomorrow night in Oklahoma City to take on the Thunder. Reports say that Nikola Mirotic is getting closer to returning after he got sucker punched by his teammate. broke a couple bones, concussions. Hey, tough love. Get back out there. But I guess he's back at the Advocate Center, and he still hasn't talked to Bobby Portis, his attacker slash teammate. So that's all cold, and it's having an effect on team chemistry, which is the last thing this 2-8 team needs. If they had better chemistry, well, they'd still be 2-8. Right now, they are third worst in the NBA, but it's early. They can get there. And the winter baseball meetings have begun. John Lackey is not retiring. That was the big thing. He's still playing. Big country. Could return to the Cubs even. Melky Cabrera could come back to the White Sox, and ESPN is reporting that the Orioles are listening to offers for stud reliever Zach Britton. And one of the teams linked are the Cubbies. Oh, there you go. And finally tonight, the Blommer Chocolate Factory was on fire today, proving the old adage, chocolate melts in your mouth, but not on your roof. There you go. That's the carryout for November 14, 2017. The carryout is now too offering delivery after today's announcement that Portillo's is doing the same. So, yes, we will deliver your food, but for now just to the foyer. So you got to pick it up from there. Coming up, the download on Chicago business. John Rinaldi's here. We'll talk about GeoBit, newest Chicago entry into the child monitoring businesses. And we'll talk with him about that and the challenges of technology and startups in Chicago. And Jonathan Eich joins us after 8 o'clock with his new book about Muhammad Ali. It's the download. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing well. We are continuing to monitor this Roy Moore thing out of a church in Alabama right now, Justin. It's more of a revival right now. Not sure who's speaking, but it's one of the preachers, I think, that are down there right now, and they're talking Alabama football, as a matter of fact. So,
I mean, I don't know. It seems more and more that, you know, I wonder if this is just a campaign stop and they got it on the list because everyone is hoping he's going to make some sort of news. But it seems to me when you're at the seventh song and the third preacher,
right,
maybe not necessarily caring about what news is going to be broke tonight. So
right,
we'll see what happens. But we'll over it.
We'll keep our fingers on it, and we may or may not go live with it at this point, depending.
You know what we should do? We should probably send you down to Alabama right now, Rob. I mean, by the time you get there, get on the flight, land, there'll still be a couple songs going on. I think still
I'm all for a trip. Alabama's a great state, but to cover this dog and pony show, I don't think so.
You don't think so.
It's business time.
Yes, it's time for the download on Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank here on 720 WGN. This is our weekly segment where we talk with CEOs and entrepreneurs about their stories so we can better understand ours. Tonight, a Chicago company dives into the world of modern parenting. Child monitoring devices aren't necessarily new, but the company GeoBit amassed big money to launch their product, which improves upon the GPS technology used to track your kids. It's a device that you clip onto your shirt or belt and it tracks your child with more accuracy, being able to go both outdoors and indoors. The whole concept came when John Rinaldi had a scary parent moment at Millennium Park, losing his kid for over 20 minutes. This got the entrepreneur and former vice president at Motorola interested in this market. GeoBit raised over $6 million to launch the product this year. And John Rinaldi, the CEO, in studio tonight. John, thanks for being here.
Appreciate it. Good evening. Thanks, man.
So, I guess we start with the story. I mean, is that true? Is that just a piece of folklore? I mean, is there a business opportunity out of a possible misery?
No. A couple of years ago, my wife and I, we had not been. So, totally unexpected what we're going to see. I did not expect what happened. So, my daughter was, I think she was like 4 at the time. My son was 6. So, we were more worried about her, right? Mm-hmm. Like, she's just kind of toddler age. So I had my in-laws with me, 3 adults on my daughter, and me and my son, because I got this. So we split up. I take him, and of course, I'm the one.
You're right. It always
so
works that way.
I don't know what happened, was whether it was the summer scenes in Chicago or whatever, but lost track of him pretty quick. After a couple minutes, if you're a parent, you got this tightness
in your
chest.
Yep.
You know, after a few seconds, you're worried. After a few minutes, you're losing your mind. So kind of amassed a party posse to try to start tracking him down, yelling his name, tracked all over the park looking for him. Never found him. He found me. So I don't know if he kind of saw me the whole time. But he tracked me down over about 20 minutes later, and at that time I still was trying to get a hold of my wife. I was trying to call her over and she wasn't answering her phone. So I wasn't sure if I was more worried about what she would say or not finding him.
I mean, that whole experience, and it is one that is shared and relatable. People listening now have all had, there's one experience where you lose track of your kid. I mean, obviously there is a market that, you know, comes out of that experience, child monitoring. And we're not talking about devices when kids are in the crib. We're talking about GPS watches and other wearables that have happened in the last 5 or 10 years where companies have said, hey, we can keep track of your toddlers. You're aware of that area. What makes Jiobit? Why get into that business in that area? Totally. Because you have to be competitive and you have to be somewhat new, but you're not reinventing the wheel.
Yeah. So after that, you know, I didn't know anything about any of those products, quite frankly, which is part of the problem. A lot of people will just think like, well, Fitbit,
right?
Like, that must track. It tracks health, so it must track my kid too. So there's a general lack of awareness in this category in general that there's products out there. I think, you know, some in the tech field at least know about them, but generally speaking, over 60-70% of parents have no idea that these types of products exist. And I was one of them, had no clue. But after that traumatic experience, I went out and researched and bought every probably 20-30 different types of products, put them on my kids, strapped them on their wrists. And they were all just big, bulky, terrible battery life. My kids didn't want to wear them. They were very obvious. I mean, these are the addictive.
Yeah, right.
Watches.
Yeah,
massive,
of course.
Things,
like,
right?
The strange plastic things on wrists. Yeah. I've seen them. Yeah.
And as a child, even at five, they know. Like, they're already cognizant of what other kids are going to think and what other parents think. What's this mean? And so to me, what was apparent, not just that they didn't fit or that the engineering was terrible and the battery life was all, like, all those things that made sense to me as a parent, but my kids just wouldn't wear them because they were afraid to get made fun of at school, or the teachers would make them take them off. And so to me, the kind of the genesis of this story was like, take this learning and what I went through as a real customer. Looking back at things like battery life, these things lasted a day. I'm not going to use this thing. I got to charge so many other tablets and phones and everything else in my house. This thing's got to last weeks. It's got to be super tiny and discreet. It can't go on their wrist. Kids mm-hmm. don't want to, like, at that age, right? Wrist watches are a thing for adults, right? And I think they see some of that where they want to emulate maybe an Apple Watch, but these Dick Tracy watches are massive.
Well, what's great about the story and what makes it great to talk about when you talk about the Download in Chicago business is just this idea of improving upon. You know, these are the early adapters, if you will, of this technology. And for you to come in, what makes, from your background at Motorola and other places, and being in the tech area, is that what you bring to the table? Not just the idea that you know how to improve upon a product, but also the relationships to be able to go to people and say, I've got an improvement. Let's invest.
Yeah. You know, I think in this area, in tech in general, there's lots of times where being first to market doesn't mean that that's the winner. Whether it was Apple with the smartphone, they weren't the first one. Motorola had a smartphone years before,
right?
A touchscreen device. U.S. carriers said no customers want that. That's just for the Chinese market. There were smart thermostats before Nest, and so it takes a team that's going to look at the user experience, design, form factor, usage, all of the things that are going to make this special. And identifying those things that are going to make people really, those magic moments that are going to make people say, wow. And so for us, we found pretty quickly that, you know, just as a parent and then researching this more, doing in-home studies, we found that, you know, not only was the form factor a big problem, not only was design a big problem, not only engineering was a big problem. But this idea of having something that was really worry-free, I didn't have to worry about constantly charging this. In a sense, mm-hmm. our job that we're doing is relieving stress and anxiety for the parent. Give your kids some more freedom.
Is that how you approach investors? I mean, is that the when you're talking about a pitch? I mean, right off the bat, I mean, those stories about Apple or about Nest, those are stories that relate to everybody. I mean, anyone in a room say, I guess you're right. Yeah, there were other products before these products hit. And then secondly, the idea that you are selling to something that you are fixing for people, anxiety, stress, worry, those kind of things.
And to some extent also, the market, while these aren't new ideas, there's been ideas like for the smartphone. Sometimes it takes the market a time to be ready for it. And we have now millennials that are starting to have kids. Their first babies are fur babies, and then there's their practice kids.
Right.
And now they're starting to have real kids. And so you have a market that's coming together at the same time that the technology has evolved to do something about it. So it takes an old idea, perfects it, takes it to the really the next level, and it takes a group of really talented engineers and designers to pull this off. And fortunately, we've been super blessed by having a great network here in Chicago and out west too to help us with that.
John Rinaldi is the CEO and co-founder of Jiobit. That's J-I-O-B-I-T, a child monitoring device that is here in Chicago. It's about to launch. The product's about to launch. Let's talk about that process when we return here on The Download in Chicago Business. John Rinaldi, my guest. Stay with us.
It's business time.
It is The Download in Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. John Rinaldi in studio. He's the CEO and co-founder of Jiobit, new child monitoring device, GPS device that really improves upon the technology that of a lot of devices that have been out there to successfully monitor your kids. And right away, I mean, you kind of said it at the beginning of the segment about a lot of people aren't, they just don't know the market. They don't know these devices exist. But then the ones that do also are aware of some of the challenges that go along with GPS tracking. Most notably, that the wrong people track. I mean, in open source, you can get people can hack it, and you don't people that you don't want tracking your loved ones are tracking your loved ones. How do you deal with that kind of, I guess, storyline that comes around GPS monitoring devices?
It's probably the second question that we get. And we knew that going in right away, we needed to be not just a little bit better, but just take it on straight on, and really over-engineer it in security. So it wasn't just about doing the bare minimum. It was going to make this, you know, to the same levels that, say, like the military would use for security, something that the wearable industry, this industry had never done before. So we took on a very ambitious project to implement some technologies around encryption that go light years above the standards. And what that means is that the device not only has the data encrypted in every single transaction, it's encrypted on the device itself. And it uses the same type of technology that's in like your chip and PIN credit card. So in the factory, we burn in these encryption keys actually into the silicon. And so if that technology more or less is cracked, we've got bigger problems in this world. It means your credit card's hacked
right.
inside of your credit card itself. So that tape, like that smart chip, that's a similar type of technology.
Does that change when you want to get in the business, especially in the business of tech, and when you talk about GPS and location devices, things of that nature? Do you have to start thinking that way when you're raising capital and thinking about investment that it's going to cost a little bit more to make these because of the security issues?
Totally. Not just security issues, but anything. In a startup, there's so many unknowns when you get going. You think, you think you know everything, but you don't. There's so many of the unknown unknowns out there. And so you always try to budget for that risk, budget for those delays. And we're no different. We were well on our product. We were probably only 6 months away from launching last year. And we came into a massive antenna issue where we couldn't have a product. While it would work great in the office, work great in some small beta trials, it wasn't something that was going to work reliably all the time. And this type of product needs to, right? I mean, this is something where you can't just, like, your kid runs away, like, oh,
No, that's what you're selling. You're selling there, right?
And so the antenna system, the reliability of the radios in this had to be that of what you'd expect from your smartphone, and so or beyond. And so we made that hard call that we just weren't there. And we had to reset the clock. It cost us about 3 months delay and a couple $100,000.
I think about your time as a VP at Motorola, and I think about the early days of tech here in Chicago, where there was a lot of rollout deadlines and this product is coming out. But now it's not because we're working in this technology. I mean, what have you taken from that job, from working at such a big tech company and one that has had a lot of ups and downs in its time? And brought to Jiobit?
So certainly the technology, the wherewithal of building consumer electronics, bringing a team to bear, all contributed massively to this. At least you know going into it some of the risks, right? There's a lot of teams in IoT and connected hardware that just don't even know what they're getting into. So to some extent, we at least knew some of the risks. We knew some of those areas that would be challenging to us and how to recover. The best teams, I think, are those that then can recover quickly and fail fast, fail often. Hopefully not too often. So you know, I think that knowledge coming in was super important. And you have to keep a deadline, no doubt. But at the same time, you can't, like, as we said, we're not going to go out there and ship a subpar product. There's a lot of expectations for this. So you've got to think about that and make sure you're delivering those.
It is yet to be launched. And when you look on the web, if you look on the articles that are written about your company, and even the idea of raising over $6 million in capital, you almost get the idea that this has been around forever. I mean, everything about it, the videos, the marketing, it does. It feels like I just need to find the little cart to buy this right now. Yep. But it hasn't launched yet. Talk about this. Is that the strategy to make this feel like it's a household item before it's actually available?
Well, I think, you know, to some extent, many hardware companies and consumer electronics, the death sentence can be going into retail or going too wide too fast. If you've got a small hardware issue, you've got to recall 10, 20, 30,000, 50,000, 100,000 of units that can immediately tank you. You can't recover that from being a small company. So it's about really having control over your distribution channels in the beginning. And luckily, over the past 10 years, we've been blessed with e-commerce, allowing that to really proliferate and allow smaller companies fairly inexpensively to be able to distribute those products. With the advent of digital marketing, Facebook, others, you can acquire customers at a reasonable way. So it's getting them familiar with your brand, taking ownership and control of that, and then over time starting to.
And when's it going to be launched?
Hopefully here in the next couple months.
All right. So my last question is just about Chicago. You spent your time at Motorola. I mean, obviously that company has birthed a lot of tech companies and also tech people in this town. A lot of times people getting laid off or downsized out of those towns. But talk about why set this up in Chicago, because a lot of people out west as well for this company. What is it about Chicago that keeps you here?
Yeah. So one of my ex-bosses, who I'll remain nameless, but let's just say he's a very high executive out west with a company you all know. and when I met with him, I mentioned that I was thinking about starting my business. He looked at me and goes, "Don't start a business out here. Start in Chicago." And the reason why is attrition is super, you know, it's a massive problem. It's super high out west. People in Chicago, generally speaking, are more loyal. They're more passionate about those things. They're going to stick with it. And generally speaking, it's a lower cost to acquire them. So, you know, very dollars and cents speaking, you can acquire, let's call them, just as good, if not better people at a much lower cost, and people that will be more passionate about your business, your product, and stick with you versus constantly worrying about replacing them every 18 months because they went to the next whiz-bang thing down the street. So I took that to heart, and unfortunately, I've born and raised here. I know a lot of folks out west. We have a team in Menlo Park. They're awesome. They're fantastic people, and they're super loyal and great folks too. But you know, for their hardware team and for the majority of the company, we chose Chicago for some of those reasons.
John Rinaldi is the co-founder and CEO of Geobit, J-I-O-B-I-T, which is a GPS child tracking service, which will be out soon here in Chicago, and our guest tonight on Downloading Chicago Business. John, thanks for being here, man. Appreciate
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is the author of the new book, Ali, The Life. It's a biography of the life of one of the greatest athletes in history, written by Chicago author Jonathan Eig. What's surprising about this incredible work is that it's the first definitive biography of the famed boxer and activist Muhammad Ali. Yes, there have been plenty of books written about him, his fights, also plenty of documentaries, even an award-winning film, but they all took from parts of the story. This is the first full story of the complex, complicated, legendary figure. It's unauthorized, it's honest, brutally so at times. And it looks at the life that is almost overshadowed by the legend. It's also a book that looks at a life of contrast, a story of a man who wanted to be loved and in so many ways loved to be despised. Eig is no stranger to biographies. He's written about Jackie Robinson, Lou Gehrig, and even the birth control pill. He's a longtime writer here in town. My pleasure to welcome Jonathan Eig to the big table. Jonathan, great to see you.
You too. Thanks.
This is unbelievable work. And a work that has consumed you for five years plus. First of all, I'm so interested in this being the only biography of Muhammad Ali? Because I just feel like there have been many books written about him.
There have been many books, a lot of great books. Norman Mailer, George Plimpton, you know, writers that are, you know, my heroes. David Remnick wrote a good book, but they all took slices of the story. They all took little pieces. And
about one fight.
About one fight or the Vietnam years. And what nobody had done is just stepped back and said, wait a second, this is one of the great lives of the 20th century. We should be treating him the way we treat George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. We need a big, fat biography that looks at everything, that interviews everybody who knew him, that goes through the FBI records, that just treats him like a piece of history that he is. And you know, it was perfect timing because enough time had gone by. It's 50 years since he became champ and since he protested Vietnam. But you've also still got like three out of his four wives still alive. You've got his brother still alive. You've got half the men who he fought still alive. So it was the perfect time to do this. And I interviewed everybody.
Hundreds of interviews. Talk about when you set out to do this, was the idea to do a front-to-back full-life look at Muhammad Ali?
That was it, because I realized that's what was missing. That you know, the way to do this, the way to beat the competition was to go big. And to do the book bigger and better, I hope, than anybody had ever done it.
Was there any temptation to make it authorized? Because it was unauthorized. You wanted to be a journalist and look at this objectively. But was there temptation? Because I know the Ali family said, hey, we've got an idea. I mean, talk about trying to keep it objective and independent and the goal of doing that.
Yeah, the family and the Ali marketing company came to me when they heard I was doing this. And said, would you consider making this an authorized book? We'll give you access to Ali. We'll help you sell it. We'll promote it. And we'll share the money. And I said, no, not even going to think about
it. This is while he was living, right?
While he was still alive. Yeah, this was like 2013, I think. I was just getting started. And I said, that's not even a question. I wouldn't dream of doing that because I need to be objective. I need to have I need to be free to write what I want, and including the negative stuff. And I said to them, frankly, I think that's in your best interest, too, because Ali deserves a real biography, not just some slicked-up, polished, brand-building product.
He's got enough of that.
He's got enough of that.
When you do a project like this, and with your background doing biographies but also being a journalist, do you put out a mission statement? Do you say, okay, not only is this going to be a definitive bio, but I'm going to try and uncover the truths of Muhammad Ali. I'm going to look at that legend and kind of poke holes in what's true and what's not. Is there more than just going front to back when it comes to a biography?
I wouldn't like put out a mission statement, but the whole point of writing a biography is to help your reader understand who he really was, to try to get as close as you can to the truth as possible. I'm obviously, there's no such thing as one truth, but I'm going into this just trying to be as open and as honest as I can, figure out who made this guy, like how did he turn out this way, and how did he change the world, and I'm not going to let anybody try to, you know, sway me or try to, like, I'm not trying to spin this in one direction or another,
right.
I'm not selling anything, and I'm not out to take him down, and I'm not out to pretty him up either.
What's amazing is that what you're really pushing against is the legend of Muhammad Ali. There's so many stories we know in American history where you're like, okay, that Muhammad Ali threw his medal into the river,
or it didn't happen.
Yeah, but other things like that. In a way, your biography debunks that, or even, and we'll talk about it in this interview. But the contrast, I can't wait till we get to the Vietnam stuff because we all remember the conscientious objector. We remember him being the voice of the civil rights movement, but it's not necessarily how it was played out. When you look at all of the interviews he did at that time, he's kind of all over the place.
He's a really complicated guy, and his life is a mess at times. You know, he's got these great religious principles, which he violates all the time. He takes this conscientious objector status to the war, but he at one point said, you know, just take my money and go buy bomber jets and kill all the Vietnamese you want. So he's really hard to figure out, and that's what makes it so much fun for me, and that's what makes him real. Because if you just pretty him up, if you just tell the myths over and over again, then you get George Washington chopping down the cherry tree, and you don't know anything about the real man who was behind those stories.
Well, let's get into the real man, Muhammad Ali. The book is called Ali, The Life. We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll start at the beginning about his humble beginnings in Louisville, Kentucky. Jonathan Eig is the author. He's my guest tonight at the big table. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio, Jonathan Eig. He's the author of the new book, Ali, The Life. It's the definitive biography of Muhammad Ali from front to back. Surprising to me, the first definitive full biography of Muhammad Ali. It's hard to believe, but you're right. When you go through all the other pieces that have been done, it's always a sliver, or it's about the rumble in the jungle, or it's about one period of his life. But you go and talk about his entire life. Let's start at the beginning. fascinating to me that he grew up in Louisville. Right out the gate, they misspell his name on the birth certificate. You find all of this stuff in your research.
Yeah, I was able to find out, first of all, that they misspelled his name on his birth certificate. His grandfather was a convicted murderer, something Ali didn't know. He killed a man over a craps game in Louisville. Great-grandson of a slave, grandson of a convicted murderer, son of a drunk wife beater, and this is who becomes the greatest man of the 20th century, you know, the most famous man of the 20th century.
There's a great passage where you talk about his father, Muhammad Ali's father, Cassius Clay's father, Cash as well, and the lessons that he taught his sons in this case. But he taught Cassius about inequality, about how black people were treated, and he also, by living in the world that he was living, showed a lot about abuse and how to treat women. But there was a lot that came from the stuff that you were able to research about his father.
Yeah, you can see the two sides of Ali's personality at war, this sweet, loving side that's so gregarious that everybody just is charmed by. That comes from his mother. And you see the fighter and the race warrior and the womanizer. That comes from his father. These two conflicting personalities almost, you know, battling it out punch for punch in Ali's psyche. His father was a really difficult guy, but I think if without his father, he doesn't become the man who, you know, sets out to see if he can change the world, who says that I don't have to accept things the way I find them.
What's interesting is that he's not, we have so many different musicians and talented artists and athletes that are on this program, and they talk, when I was 5 years old, I did this, and it was unbelievable. Muhammad Ali, not really in the first 12 years of his life, that gifted in one way or the other, not necessarily the best athlete, not, you know, not the best charmer, everything in between. It wasn't until he actually had a chance encounter where he was looking for a stolen bike that he stumbled upon a gym.
Yeah, that's right. He was not a great athlete, didn't really like football or basketball or baseball, but he loses his bike. His bike is stolen. He goes looking for a police officer to report it to, and the police officer happens to be running a boxing clinic. He finds a guy in a basement of a gym who's running a boxing clinic, and the police officer says, well, you want to learn to fight? And Ali becomes intrigued. He likes the sights, the smell of the ring, but most importantly, I think he sees white kids getting punched in the face by black kids. And you're not supposed to do that in Jim Crow Louisville in the 1950s. So he's intrigued by that maybe more than anything else. And the legend of that lost bike is really central to Ali. It happens to be one of those legends that turns out to be true. He really did have his bike stolen, and that led him into the boxing ring.
When I think about that, too, the next step is to talk about what boxing was like at that time. If you were into boxing in the 1950s, you had Jack Johnson,
right.
Joe Louis, mm-hmm. and they were completely different types of boxers. You had Joe Louis, who was a black boxer who could go in the ring and beat white fighters, but society was like, as long as you do it in the ring and you're respectful outside the ring. And Jack Johnson was entirely the other way. He was very flamboyant, and Cassius Clay at the time looked at Jack Johnson more of a model than Joe Louis.
That's right. Joe Louis was told, you know, you can't even raise your hands in triumph. You can't gloat over a fallen white man, because that would be suggesting that the black man was really superior. Even though he just beat the crap out of him, you can't act like you're better than that white guy. And young Cassius Clay says, what's up with that? You know, I don't have to do that. And as soon as he starts winning, he starts bragging about it and gloating and saying, I'm the greatest of all time. I can beat anybody. I'm better than Rocky Marciano ever was. I'm better than Joe Louis. I'm the greatest of all time. He's only 19 years old, but he's already bragging.
What'd they get, the Louisville Lip?
The Louisville Lip was his first nickname, and that was not meant to be polite or even amusing. It was because sports writers thought he was obnoxious.
Early on, to think about how he was despised even when he got to the top, he was despised locally. Like, there were a lot of sports writers when he started boxing that were like, all right, shut up.
Yeah, he's unsportsmanlike. Plus, he's black, and, you know, black people are not supposed to give any lip to white people at the time. So he's in big trouble for that. And that's even before he joins the Nation of Islam. And then it gets worse by a magnitude.
Really the turning point in his career, the 1960 Olympics. He has a tremendous fight when he's, what, 18, 19 years old. And then I think he's 20, he goes to the Olympics. He wins the gold medal at the Olympics. This is really where his career starts to take off, because it's just a matter of time before he's in the ring with Sonny Liston, and then his career, then he's the boxer we all know.
Yeah, and what happens at the Olympics is important, too, because he doesn't really look like a great fighter. And if you watch the early films of his fights, even in the Olympics and his first couple of pro fights, he doesn't look very good. And his technique is terrible. He's never really learned to box properly. And the only reason he's getting talked about as a potential opponent for the champ, Sonny Liston, is because he's such an amazing personality.
Yeah, keep talking.
He's the star of the Olympics because he's like the mayor of the village. Everybody just wants to be around him. He's such fun, and he gives such great quotes to the reporters that he's just like an instant story. You know, journalists would say all the time that anybody could write a great story about Cassius Clay or Muhammad Ali, because you just had to be around him, and he'd fill your notebook or your tape recorder with gold. So he starts getting talked about as a challenger for Sonny Liston just because they know he can sell tickets. He's a born promoter.
It's beyond just charm. He has a rhythm. He has a style in which he's talking. Spoken word almost, a rhyme. I mean, everything about him is – you never see that from an athlete, especially in the early 60s.
He's clever. He's funny as hell. And people can't get enough of it. So everybody assumes it's going to be over when he meets Liston, because Liston's going to kill this guy. But it's fun while it lasts. That's the attitude.
Up to that fight – what we knew of Cassius Clay was that he was a fast talker, and he was good, but he wasn't a great fighter. He was even undersized. And when you talk about a heavyweight fighter, he might fit the weight requirement, but he wasn't the right size to take on a Sonny Liston. So it wasn't until he got into the ring that anyone really had any respect for him.
Yeah, that's right. And people, well, because he was so fast and because he was built so beautifully, he didn't look like he was that big. But when you get in the ring against him, his opponents found out, wait a second, he actually hits pretty hard. That jab starts to wear you out after a while. And he was 6'3", you know, 210 at that point, pretty big. You know, so Sonny Liston looks like he's bigger and scarier. But once they get in there and Liston can't touch him because Ali's so fast, and then that jab starts to hit, and then Liston starts to slow down a little bit, and then the combinations start flying, suddenly Liston looks like a weak old man compared to this kid who's faster and big enough at that point.
Now, that's the last fight. The victory over Sonny Liston is really the last fight for Cassius Clay, because it's, what is it, the next morning that he wants to change his name, and then a month later he changed it to Muhammad Ali. But that was the moment in which this star was born, and so much so he even changed his name.
Absolutely. He comes out the next morning and says, I'm not a Christian anymore. That's a religion that was pushed on me when my people were slaves. And I don't have to be what you want me to be anymore. I'm the champion of the world. I don't have to do what you want me to do anymore. I'm free. And it's this massive declaration of independence, and it's met instantly with wild, wild hatred. Like, who the hell do you think you are? You know, followed by the N-word. And he becomes despised. If you thought he was unpopular before just for being a little sassy, now he's declaring alliance to the Nation of Islam, which most Americans consider to be like a terrorist group bent on the destruction of America.
Ringside is Malcolm X.
Yeah, Malcolm X is right there by his side. And Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad, these are people the FBI is scared of. And most white Americans are just, you know, confused by, like, what's wrong with these people? So for Ali to join them, for the heavyweight champ who's supposed to be a symbol of American strength and honor, this is heresy.
It's amazing, the contrast. Because we just talked about at the Olympic Village, he's the mayor, he's Mr. Charm. Everyone wants to be around him. And then it takes him at the top. He gets to the top. You'd think that'd be the moment. And he uses that platform to declare independence, and he goes from the most charming and most liked to the most hated.
Yeah, and that was always a war within Ali. He wanted to be the most popular guy. He wanted to be loved. And he wanted to piss you off and rebel. So he's flushing Coca-Cola contracts down the toilet. Nobody's going to want an endorsement from this guy with this funny new name that nobody can spell or pronounce. And reporters refuse to use it. They keep calling him Cassius Clay. The New York Times, everybody else keep calling him Cassius Clay. So he's willing to throw it all away because he believes he can take a stand, that he can challenge authority, and that's what really matters to him.
Jonathan Eig is my guest tonight. His new book, Ali, The Life, is the definitive biography of Muhammad Ali, one of the greatest athletes in history. We're talking about that. We want to talk more about the contrast and all the contrast that's coming up here on The Download. We'll take a break for the news. We'll come back. Jonathan Eig, my guest at the big table. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the big table, the author of the new book, Ali, The Life, the definitive biography of Muhammad Ali. Jonathan Eig is an in-studio Chicago writer who's also written about Jackie Robinson, Lou Gehrig, the birth control pill, as well as many other things. We'll pick up where we left off with contrast. Muhammad Ali, at this point, he beats Sonny Liston. He declares his independence not just as a boxer, as an athlete, but as a man. He determines religion is one that was forced upon him. He doesn't have to do what the white man has to tell him. He changes, changes the course of American athletics in a way, in a way that he brought politics in. He quickly became, he was loved, and now he's despised. What's next for him? Because it was a month later that he changes his name to Muhammad Ali. But he then, I guess the next step in his story is Vietnam.
Yeah, he begins to say, I don't want to go. First, he fails his IQ test, so he doesn't have to go. And then they need more soldiers, so they lower the cutoff rate, and they say, well, now you're eligible. And he says, wait a second, I'm not any smarter than I was last time. How come I was too stupid for the Army before, and now they want me?
And he's also the heavyweight champion of the world at that point.
Yeah,
and we see in history, I was talking to Pete about this earlier, but we see in history a lot of prominent figures being able to defer or find a way to get out of service. Muhammad Ali, they're saying, it's your time.
Yeah, that's right. And some people suggest that maybe it's he's being picked on. Maybe it's racist. Maybe they're trying to shut him up because they don't like his politics, because he's a member of this strange group, the Nation of Islam. And Ali at first isn't really helping his own cause. He says, well, I'm making a lot of money as a boxer, millions and millions of dollars, tax dollars that I'm raising. You can use that money to buy bomber jets and tanks and kill all the Vietnamese you want. I don't care. Just don't send me over there. Send some football players. They're bigger and stronger than I am. And then he says, well, wait a second. This whole war is racist. You know, black people are being drafted disproportionate numbers. If you're white.
Viet Cong never did anything.
Yeah, Viet Cong never called me the N-word. And if you're white, you can just call your daddy's lawyer and get a deferral. But why are they picking on black people? And I don't want to go over there and kill some dark-skinned people. And then he finally begins to say, well, this is against my religion. And that's the argument he ends up taking to the Supreme Court. He's convicted. He's sentenced to 5 years in jail. He loses his boxing license. He loses his heavyweight championship. Can't make a living. And has to, you know, appeal the case. He remains free. He doesn't go to jail. But while his case is being appealed, he remains free.
But he can't box at that point.
Camp loses the 3.5 years of his prime, probably the best years that he would have had as a boxer.
I feel like, Jonathan, that's a part of the story that for my generation and for generations past me don't know. Thinking about it as I'm reading this, I'm like, I can't believe that Muhammad Ali in the prime of his life, the one that we celebrate, was stripped of his boxing titles, was told he could never box again because of his position in the Vietnam War.
Yeah, if you think what Colin Kaepernick's going through now, imagine Ali. It was a million times worse, and he was the most hated man in America, at least in white America. He was despised. You know, not only did he lose his boxing license and his ability to make money in the ring, but he lost millions of dollars of endorsements. And it looked like he was going to go to jail. And he was offered a compromise. He was offered a deal where he would just box some exhibitions for the military. He said, hell no. This is my religious principles. It's all or nothing. I'm not going to violate my religious principles. I'd rather face a firing squad. He meant it.
And this is, one of these areas of contrast where America and history remembers he was a conscientious objector because he had the famous line about the Viet Cong, and this was all about he was standing up for civil rights. But as you just pointed out, he had five different every time he was asked, he had a different answer on why he didn't want to go to war. So again, we remember a certain part of the legend of Muhammad Ali, but it might not necessarily be accurate.
That's right. And what matters is that he stood up for his convictions. That's what makes him courageous. But you have to also remember that he was not a civil rights warrior. He was opposed to the civil rights movement. He thought that integration was a terrible idea and that black people should live separately, and that until America allowed black people to live separately, there would never be peace. He was opposed to integration. He was opposed to intermarriage. He said he would never never want to see his children dating white people. Mm-hmm. He was, he's a very controversial, complicated guy.
Over time, getting to the 80s, 90s, 2000s, even when he was ill at the end of his life, did he look back and ever try to correct that narrative? Is there ever any interviews or other places where he says, everyone's got the wrong idea of what I was trying to do?
You know, it was really funny, and one of the things that drove me crazy for a while. In the late 70s, somebody said to him, do you have any regrets in life? Anything you would do differently? And he said, yeah, I wish I hadn't said that thing about the Viet Cong. I couldn't believe it. I was, what are you talking about? That's the most important thing you ever said. That's the reason that you are considered the most important athlete of the 20th century, because you took a stand against the war. What do you mean? And he said, well, I just wish that I hadn't made people so angry. And that's when it hit me that he, as much as he wanted to be admired, as much as he wanted to be seen as this icon, this important rebel, he also just really wanted to be loved. He couldn't stand the fact that people were mad at him.
It's a narrative in the book that from an early age, you paint a picture of a man who was searching out love, whether it was through love and his four marriages, the mistresses that were involved, and beyond that, the way that he would be charismatic to people on the street. If you walked by Muhammad Ali on the street, he would make sure to try and stop you to say, do you know who I am? There's a lot in there about him searching for love or wanting to be the center of attention or the center to be loved at all times.
Yeah, and maybe it comes from living with an abusive father. Maybe it's something else. You know, who knows? I'm not going to pretend to read his mind, but he absolutely just needed it. He hungered for it. If he was driving down the street and people didn't notice him, he would, you know, hang out the window. He would he once drove on the sidewalk of Michigan Avenue just because people weren't noticing him enough. And he figured, well, I better just drive on the sidewalk. That'll get people's attention.
It's kind of interesting when you think about today's world and you think about some of our leaders and celebrities and their relationship with fame. And the higher that you go, I think about the biggest, prominent, most, you know, influential people on Twitter. With that fame and that adulation or adoration comes this river of hate. Like you never can get to one place where there's 100% where people just love you. And it's interesting with Muhammad Ali, the higher he got, the bigger he became, the more hate was created.
Yeah, until the 70s, I think it starts to shift. You know, he's beaten by Joe Frazier. He has to fight his way back. He's seen as a martyr for the sacrifice he made in Vietnam. And he shuts up about politics and race to some extent. You know, he really just wants to be a celebrity at that point. And the 70s, you know, the society's changing. The Jeffersons are on TV and we have a different attitude about integration. And he starts to become much more beloved. And he likes it. He doesn't really want to go back to being the rebel anymore. And then late in his career, he starts getting slower. He's suffering the effects from all those punches. He starts losing his ability to speak clearly. And then by the time he retires, his hands are shaking. And he becomes like a lot more, I don't want to say pitiful, but we start to feel
sanctified.
Bad for him.
We see him as – we put him on a pedestal.
Yeah.
A lot because of his illness.
Yeah, we want him to be an angel. We want to put our arms around him and hug him, and we forgive all the stuff that ticked us off so much in the beginning. And because he doesn't really speak as much, it's easy to sort of imagine that he is all things to all people.
A lot of the contrast, and we haven't really even gotten into the, and we probably won't, but the Nation of Islam and his religious discipline versus the way he lived his life, which are complete contrasts. He had four different wives, one which the Nation of Islam wanted him to divorce. But then on top of it, the way that he womanized, even in front of his wives, you talk to some of his wives, or they've been interviewed at times, talked about just how he almost used sex in the same way that we're talking about, that he this need to be loved. It's one great passage where one of his wives says he didn't even like sex. He just did it because it had so much more attached to it. And that's another part where he will always be remembered, especially in this rebellious time, as being this religious, pious man who stood for his convictions, even made a change in his religious philosophies. But there was a lot going on that America did not know about.
Yeah, it's very hard to make it all fit. You know, here's a guy who absolutely loved his first wife, but divorced her because the Nation of Islam told him to, because she wouldn't become a member of the religion. And then he remarries a young woman, 17 years old, who grew up in the Nation of Islam and is, you know, absolutely devout. But he begins cheating on her, you know, almost immediately, and expects her to go along with it, expects her to book rooms for the mistresses. And some of this comes from, again, having a father who was a playboy. Some of it comes from Elijah Muhammad, who, you know.
Some of it comes from being the most successful.
And some of it just comes from
the famous person in the world.
Being famous and beautiful and the heavyweight champion of the world. And from the 1970s when, you know, society was pretty loose about sex. So all these forces come together, and it makes for, you know, a crazy, crazy life that doesn't make sense if you just try to line it up with where his philosophy should lie.
Again, it doesn't gel with that legend.
No, but that's life, you know.
And, that is life, yes.
I think it's so important for people to read books about their heroes and not just look for them to be perfect. You know, accept the fact that these are human beings, and that's why they're interesting, and that's why, you know, they wouldn't be important if they were comic book characters or movie heroes.
The investigative part of your book, which is – there's a lot in here that's investigative. You do a tremendous job with interviews and everything. The brain function part of this, where you're able to map where you start to see Muhammad Ali lose function earlier than we see it. The idea that at the beginning of his life as Cassius Clay, he's – like we talked about, spoken word, rhyme. He is a talker, the Louisville Lip, right?
Right.
But over time, as he continues in this career of boxing and taking punishment, that skill deteriorates.
Yeah, the point of boxing is really to concuss your opponent, to cause brain damage. And nobody really escapes that, especially if you fight 20 years like Ali did, or, you know, 30 years if you include his amateur boxing. So what I did was I worked with CompuBox to count the number of punches that Ali was hit with over the course of his career. We counted every punch,
wow,
round by round, fight by fight. And we can look at any punch, any fight, and pick out a round and see how many times he was hit, how many times he hit his opponent. And you start to see in the second half of his career, he's getting out hit dramatically. He's letting his opponents hit him until they get tired. And then he starts to fight back, which is a terrible, terrible formula for your brain's health. It might have won him a few fights, but it was not a smart. And he even began encouraging his sparring partners just to hit him in the head. He would keep his hands down because he believed he could build up resistance, that if he took enough shots to the head, kind of like building up calluses, he'd be, you know, immune to the knockout. And then I also worked with speech scientists to track his rate of speech, and he loses 26% of his speaking rate from age 30 to age 40 at a time when you shouldn't be losing any of your speaking rate. I'm speaking now just as fast as I did when I was 25, I hope, but I should be. He lost 26% of his speaking ability, and it started in 1970, 71 when he was, you know, only 30 years old.
Wow. You had a chance to meet Muhammad Ali. He obviously didn't interview him for this book, but you had a slight encounter.
Yeah.
With him. Tell us about it.
Oh, man. I spent three and a half years trying to meet him and trying to ask him some questions, hoping that I could at least, you know, shake his hand and tell him I was doing this book. I went to his house and spent hours there, but he was not well and didn't come out of his room. I went to two or three different fundraisers where he was scheduled to appear, and he didn't make it. And finally, in the fall of 2015, I went to Louisville where he was getting an award, and I saw him sitting alone with his wife at the table. I was the only one in the room. I ran to the table, and I said hello to his wife, and she introduced me to Muhammad. And I was so nervous. I didn't know what I was going to say. I'd been, you know, dreaming of this moment for years. And finally, I just went up to him, and I held his hand, and I looked him in the eye, and I said, I'm writing your biography, and I know you didn't ask me to. I'm trying my hardest to do it right, and I'm so honored to have this privilege. And is there anything you want to say? I mean, you know, the last word is yours. And I stopped and I listened and I put my ear right by his side of his head, and he didn't say anything. And it was hard for me. You know, I was hoping for some kind of epiphany, some kind of a message, rosebud, you know. But it was okay, because I think, you know, the message that I took away from it was that it was his life, and it's my book, and it was my job to tell it. And I tried to do it as well as I could.
At the end of this book and this project, which has consumed half a decade,
yeah,
do you consider Muhammad Ali the greatest?
Yeah, without a doubt. He's great. He includes so much complication, so much contradiction, and greatness is an order of magnitude, and he contains multiple dimensions. He's so fascinating to me. You know, I don't always like him as much as I used to. There are things about him that I wish could have been different, but I think of him as being one of the greatest figures of the 20th century, and certainly the greatest that I've ever written about.
Jonathan Eig is the author of Ali, The Life, the Biography of Muhammad Ali. It's out now. It's new. Jonathan, of course, wrote about Jackie Robinson, Lou Gehrig, The Birth Control Pill, and other books as well, and writings. Jonathan, great to have you here. Great story, and thanks so much for being my guest at the big table.
Thank you.
We have Jonathan Eig in studio. He said that was the first time he was on the show. I'm like, what? I've had you? Oh, yeah, I guess not. I've known him for a long time just for his different works because, you know, he did the, I guess we never did the book and I wanted to, but he did the biography, essentially a history of the birth control pill. And that was a huge book he did a couple years back. But this Ali of Life, he's getting great reviews. Good to hear. Chicago writer. I mean, it's massive, 500 plus pages. And it really is, if you're at all, I mean, even if you aren't a boxing fan or a sports fan per se, but you live through it, it becomes a history lesson. And it's so much more about what we don't remember than what we do. That's the contrast part of it. So great, great work by Jonathan Eig. Coming up here in the 9 o'clock hour tonight, Calvin Johnson's going to join us. He's the legendary founder of K Records, DIY champ. Here's the thing. He put Olympia Washington on the map. Early records albums he produced from Beck, Modest Mouse. really kind of the precursor to grunge. Olympia and Seattle had this great rivalry, still do. But we'll talk with Calvin Johnson, not just about K Records, which is an infamous, if not legendary, record label out west, but he's also the man behind Selector Dub Narcotic, which is a big, I don't even know what you call it, indie dance rock, whacked out stuff. So we'll talk Calvin Johnson coming up. Also, Jordan Klepper, the host of The Opposition on Comedy Central, which can be seen after The Daily Show, just started right at the beginning of October. He's been on for just a little bit over a month. Talk with him about the transition from doing pieces on The Daily Show to being the host behind the desk, who, I mean, has to be on every single night. And I think they have reruns on Fridays, but they got to rerun something. That's the way I see it. So Jordan Klepper, who spent a lot of time here in Chicago at I.O. and Second City, we'll talk to him about what Chicago means to him and to the show that he puts on every night at Comedy Central. So that's coming up. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is the host of The Opposition on Comedy Central, which airs weeknights after The Daily Show.
Wimmer clearly didn't commit these awful, abnormal acts. Unless he did, in which case, they're fine and they're totally normal. Alabama State Auditor John Ziegler explained it perfectly.
Take Joseph and Mary. Mary was a teenager and Joseph was an adult carpenter. They became parents of Jesus. There's just nothing immoral or illegal here, maybe just a little bit unusual.
Yeah, exactly. A bit unusual. Yeah. A relationship between an adult man and a 14-year-old girl is fine. In fact, it's better than fine. It's how you make a Jesus. Maybe we're looking at this too head-on. In fact, why are we talking about Roy Moore when we're talking about Roy Moore? Relationships like this happen all the time. As historian and American Airlines Rosa Parks Ann Coulter, she reminded us when she tweeted, "Hey Dems, JFK had an extramarital affair with 19-year-old Mimi Alford when he was 45 years old." Got him. There's no difference between 14 and 19. Besides 5 years and a couple lost. And JFK was a cheater. Roy Moore was just a single 32-year-old adult man who wanted to go on a nice date with an eighth grader. Makes it more real when you put a grade to it.
Jordan Klepper is well known to many for his work on The Daily Show, but did you know that before all of his fame and his fortune, he spent his formidable years right here in Chicago? Klepper toured with Second City, but he also hosted his own late-night show at I.O. called The Late Night Late Show. Also did several improv shows in Chicago. It was a big hit, Late Night Late Show, for the theater. And who knew that years later, Klepper would be back behind the desk, albeit in a little different role. Jordan Klepper, welcome to The Download.
Justin, good to be. How are you doing?
Good, man. Good to talk to you. And congratulations on all your success. It's been over a month now, coming up on a month. How are you settling in?
I've decided I'm going to sleep now, so I think that's a good sign. I've a month of work and then a couple hours of sleep, and then I'll get up going again. So I'm getting into that pace.
Hosting a comedy show that is essentially a 25-minute monologue. It's amazing to see what you do and how much you have to script the show and write the show about the news that's happening in the moment. Not a lot of people are doing that on television, and talk about the discipline and the rigor that goes into doing that kind of comedy.
I got a great team behind me, but it's the kind of thing that, like, the news is moving so quickly right now, so you just have to sort of stay adept to it. And we have two fully scripted acts and then one big interview with a newsmaker of the day, and so it just takes a lot of focus. You wake up, everybody's pitching on the ideas of the day, the stories of the day, the takes of the day, and we try to parse it through kind of this fun point of view that this character has. You know, I play this hype version, this, like, almost alt-fringe news source character who is anti-establishment, often pro-Trump. And we sort of have to filter all of these news stories through this character each day. And I'll tell you, it's a lot of fun. Like, it is a lot of content, but it's a lot of fun to filter it through the point of view of somebody who is absurd, who is heightened. And I think it's a challenge to find different ways. So it's not just me talking each night, every single act.
Yeah.
We try to involve other citizen journalists, other actors and characters in there. We try to blow it out so it's not just like you're watching a news show. You're watching a news show that's like is pumped up on caffeine and whatever illegal substance it has, so that you can it can get a little crazy and fun sometimes.
Well, I guess it's akin to The Daily Show and the work that you did on that, and obviously as a contributor and a correspondent, you know had times where you would have more time to get ready for a piece than being the host of the opposition, where it's on you every night to get up there and perform when you guys tape the show. Talk about the adjustment you've had to make as a performer to go from something where you're a part of it to being the main part of it.
The big shift is becoming boss. Like, suddenly I'm making decisions that affect every little element of the show. And for that, I blame Jon Stewart. He kind of created this late night show format. Like, when you come to The Daily Show, you realize that it's tailored to run through his point of view, every decision run through the interest that he has, the choices that he makes, and the topics he wants to cover. And so that's sort of what we adopted as we started to build this show. Like, you have to create this machine, and this machine runs through the host. And so what I've had to get used to really quickly is, like, being able to set really talented people into the right direction so that we can all kind of be efficient work through the day. And so as a performer, it's been really fun to kind of evolve into this role, to be a host, to try to find what this guy is like day in and day out. With The Daily Show, you know, I'm on maybe a couple times a week for smaller segments. Now I have to sustain this for full episodes. But the real big shift is what I'm doing up until the show during the day. I'm suddenly not just an employee, I'm the boss. And how to really hold that over people.
Yeah,
like, it's a real
hard
status thing. So, right. However, I can really make people feel like minions. Because already it's degrading that they have to work for a schmuck like me. But if I could really use that and have them feel like they have to work for a schmuck like me, then I'm really winning.
You're really winning, yeah. The closed door, open door, closed door dynamic. You'll work on that, right? The all right, so I'm fascinated by the character, too, because as you mentioned, kind of playing an alt-fringe pro-America host. To start out and do that, and we saw it at the beginning with even the promos. I mean, you defined who the character was, China Isn't Real, and the opposition promos and commercials that were everywhere. Now that you're over a month in, how does the character evolve? How do you change it as Jordan Klepper? How do you make it something fresh every single night?
I think for what we started to find is, one, I'm trying to find a little bit more of me in the role each time. Like, this guy's hyperbolic. He definitely feels very extreme. He's built out of this very modern ideology of opposition, of being against something, which is something that lives on the fringes, the Breitbarts and what have you. But it's also something that lives on the internet. It's something that is like this trolling culture of, like, you better be vehemently against something even if you don't know what you're standing for. And it's also something that we see in the good old White House, with a guy who's not necessarily built by ideology. It's just a guy who's built by narcissism, doing whatever is best for him and how to play to a room. And so I think, like, what we're finding is that character and that voice that speaks to what's going on there. And also, we're trying to figure out, like, how do I bring my Jordan Klepper real personality out through that as well? So the audience gets to see me through this character of somebody who might be saying something that's almost the opposite of what you would believe, but you get that the performer Jordan Klepper underneath it also understands what he's doing as well.
That's a nuancing for anybody. Think about all the comics out there that do have a different character persona, but the ability to meld those together, that takes time, evolution. I mean, there's something that you don't see a lot of that being done at such a level you're doing.
Yeah. It's a fun challenge. I think, like, that's what it's something, you know, in Chicago, it's what you go to Second City and you see. You don't see stand-ups necessarily talking, you know, stand-ups are going to go, they're going to tell you about their experiences. You go to Second City and you're going to see somebody talk about, play a character who's heightening those foibles. And that's something I've always kind of loved, is like, oh, let's filter it through somebody who's flawed as opposed to me telling you what the flaws are. But with that come new challenges. Like, we will have morning meetings where we talk about what's happening, something that Trump said, something that's vile and terrible. And you're like, I know how to be mad about this, but the job of this show is showing you what's ridiculous. Yeah. So that's kind of one extra step of comedy math that we have to go through each day. Like, all right, that's how we feel, but how do we show how we feel as opposed to just tell it?
Comedy math. I love that. Jordan Klepper, my guest, the host of The Opposition on Comedy Central. You mentioned Chicago there. There's so many great Chicago people, both the citizen journalists on the show, yourself, the writing staff, so many great people you've brought together from your past in Chicago. How important is it to have familiar faces around you when you're putting a show out, but also talk about the strengths that all of those people bring to a show like this because of their time in Chicago?
Yeah, I mean, they bring it's crucial. I think I was lucky enough. I was in Chicago for 9+ years and working with so many great people at all the improv theaters there. and then coming to New York, I worked at the Upright Citizens Brigade. And the culture in all of those places is one of creativity, brainstorming, and saying yes to ideas. And I think in doing a show that is every single day, you have to have a room that is generative and doesn't judge ideas. They just are looking to make them better. And that's sort of the thing that's the bread and butter of kind of that Chicago improv scene. And so for me, it was really important to have a creative environment that echoed that kind of ideology that I had in Chicago. At the same time, it was like, let me pull these people that I've worked with for so long, who are really talented in all these different ways. People that I worked with 15 years ago on the Late Night Late Show in Chicago. People I worked with here in New York as well. And also mix that in with brand new faces with new different ideas. Like, the one big important thing, whether you're an improviser or not, whether you're from Chicago or New York or LA or the middle of the country, like, the big thing was, are you coming with that sensibility of, like, it's about making the room's ideas better, not winning the day with your idea. And so that was the point we started with.
You know, it's so fascinating too, because so many times you'll hear people talk about, or questions will be asked about, well, you came up in improvisation. Tell us how that helps you on a set or helps you with your show. In your case, you're playing a character, and improv obviously plays a role, but it's a scripted show. But the more important thing is the ideas and all of the theory, everything that goes into improv being utilized behind the scenes.
Yep. I mean, I think it's funny. I think improv is a huge part of this show, but not in the way that most people would expect. I'm not up there riffing. I mean, I'll have little riffs here and there and what have you. Where improv is a part of the show that you watch day in and day out is you're watching a show that was written by a bunch of people who are super generative, saying yes to a bunch of ideas and building off of that. So it's improv in its community. It's improv in its lack of preciousness. Like, no matter what, if you do a show every day, you can't worry about getting it perfect. You got to worry about making it work now. Mm-hmm. And it's also improv in those interviews. You're using the skill set of just listening, which is, you know, the first thing you have to do when you improvise. It's like, you got to lock in, you got to pay attention, and you got to be adaptable.
It's an amazing career that you've had, of course, being a contributor and correspondent for The Daily Show. But even before that, is like I mentioned in the lead, just the improv shows that you've done. When you set out, I mean, you set out from Kalamazoo to come to Chicago to do improv. Then you go from Chicago to New York City to get into the business. Was the end game to be where you're at now with your own political talk show, a character-driven political talk show? Or is this just the practice of yes and? Jordan Klepper saying, I'll take the opportunities where they come.
I mean, you know, it definitely was a dream to get to a place like this. But I can't say it was the thing I was always just aiming for. I think I was sort of more focused on what that next thing was. I think it is that idea of yes and. I left Kalamazoo, a guy who loved improv, a guy who did it in college, and a guy who knew that there was something in Chicago that I could kind of explore and see what that next step is. And same thing in Chicago. Like, you start to get into a community, start to figure things out and see where that leads. And I think I definitely had dreams of, like, whether it's SNL or The Daily Show, like, oh, it'd be great to find a place where I could continue to do this and to get paid to do this. But I think it's more so having those in the back of your head, but also just keep looking for opportunities and how to build on what you're already doing.
Jordan Klepper, the host of The Opposition, which can be seen on Comedy Central every night after The Daily Show. Guy who came through the Chicago improv scene and made his way to The Daily Show and now with his own show on Comedy Central. Jordan, couldn't be happier for you. Congrats on all your success, and thanks for joining us tonight. We appreciate it.
Justin, thank you, man.
Calvin Johnson up next, the legendary founder of K Records out in Olympia, Washington. Early records of Beck, Modest Mouse, and others. Talked to him about not just music history, but also about the trials and tribulations of running an independent record label, especially as you get older and you owe people money. That's essentially Calvin Johnson's world now. But we'll talk with him about the success and failures of K Records coming up here in the 9:30 segment after the 9:30 news. Jordan Klepper, of course, Chicago guy. Yeah, he was a talk show host. They did essentially, a late-night Johnny Carson kind of show at I.O. for years, and which is great, and it was a very popular show. We're talking like maybe around 2000, 2003, 2004, that kind of stuff. And the guys that helped out on that were also did the bits and were part of it, and I think of Seth Whiteberg and Steve Waltine, those are the guys who are writers on his show on The Opposition now. And Tim Baltz, who's been on the show, is one of the people that you can see. And Laura Gray, who was in Triplett here in Chicago. They're all on Comedy Central. So it's great to see a generation of Chicago improvisers. And it really does break down to generations, because you could say Tina Fey and Scott Adsit and, you know, those types, even Andy Richter and David Koechner, Jeff Garlin. Those are all one generation of comedians. Then you go to the next generation, which is like a Jason Sudeikis and a Ike Barinholtz. Then you go to another generation, which would be guys like Jordan Klepper and Steve Waltine and some of the others who are having a lot of great success right now. So it's great to see that that generation of performers who lit up the stage at I.O. for years. I mean, they were the darlings. You would get 5 stars, highly recommended, all the way across to see those guys in action. It's great to see that talent persevere to the point where they get their own show on Comedy Central. It's awesome. And to be in that spot where the Colbert Report was, that's awesome. All right, so coming up, Calvin Johnson. And then at 10 o'clock, speaking of improv royalty, TJ Jagodowski and Abby McEnany back in studio to play the worst with us. 312-981-7200. This is the worst. We complain about the worst things in society for prizes. We've got prizes tonight, so we'll do that coming up at 10 o'clock. But TJ and Abby, how awesome is that? Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is indie rock royalty. He just came through town with his band Selector, dubbed Narcotic. Chicago, give it up for Calvin Johnson. Dub Narcotic is the latest project.
That's me.
Yeah, that is you. That's right. It's the latest project for the musician and founder of K Records, Calvin Johnson, the DIY champion who put Olympia, Washington on the indie music map. He's produced several albums. He's produced several musicians, including early albums from Beck and Modest Mouse. The legend of K Records was told in the documentary The Shield Around the K. And it's my pleasure to welcome musician and founder of K Records, Calvin Johnson, to The Download tonight. Calvin, thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
I love Selector, dubbed Narcotic. Talk about this project before we get into. I want to get into the history of K Records, but
oh sure,
this project is one that's a. I love the combination, the indie rock and the funk, and I think it's the funk and the electronic that gets me. Where does the inspiration come for Selector, dubbed Narcotic?
Well, I've been doing it under different names. Dubbed Narcotic Sound System was right. A live band we operated for about 15 years. We played Chicago many times coming through here. But the people all fell away, and I still wanted to do something that had a beat and had people dancing. And I worked with this producer named Smoke M2D6, and he's just a dynamo. He works with a lot of the hip-hop artists in the Northwest, Seattle and Portland and Olympia and all around. So we collaborated on this record and got the beats together, and it was just a lot of fun. It's just a lot of fun to make it happen.
Talk about your experience with Chicago. I mean, you've come here with a lot of different projects over the years. Talk about your when you get a chance to come to Chicago, what does it bring back when it comes to memories?
Mostly the cold. You know, I do, you know, 2002, I remember coming through here and with the microphones and Kayla from The Blow, and we did a show and at the Heaven Gallery, and afterwards all the people, let's all go swimming. And we all went to Lake Michigan and went swimming, and it was really exciting. And on that tour, I think we toured around the U.S. and we probably went swimming 8 or 9 times all around. But that was the only time we went swimming, and then really felt like taking a shower.
Yeah, that's usually the reaction to a swim in the lake. But I'm fascinated. K Records, of course, is legendary. And you started it back all the way back in 1982. Take us there. Take us to that time. And first off, why you started a record label?
Well, you know, I was working with a fellow who grew up in this area. His name Bruce Pavitt, and he had a fanzine at the time called Sub Pop, Subterranean Pop, and he shortened it to Sub Pop. And he was from the Chicago area, and so he had a lot of connections to the Midwest. And he was really involved with independent artists out here. And I was from the Northwest, and I was really involved with Northwest artists. And we collaborated on the fanzine, and we did a lot of... he wanted to cover just the Northwest and the Midwest. Hmm. But it covered actually all over the world, but that was his main focus. And I think that the being in touch with so many interesting labels from Portland, Oregon, and from Cleveland, Ohio, and you know, Kansas, and it made me really feel like I wanted to contribute to that, to that legacy that was forming then in like the 78 to 82 era.
Right.
And that's, I think that doing that and working at our radio station, KAOS, which is a non-commercial community radio station that we both worked at, we just saw a lot of independent releases coming through. And we were excited by them. We were excited by the ideas of independent labels. And we both wanted to do something like that. And we had actually done that with Sub Pop. We started as a fanzine, but then it morphed into a cassette fanzine. And then the cassette fanzine later became, it had so many different, it was a radio show, it was a column, and then eventually it was a record label.
A lot of music fans will not know that a Sub Pop started as a fanzine and then something else. Just the idea that it's all part of a culture, and it's all part of a DIY culture, and the record label is just part of the things that are done in a community when you're talking about independent art.
Yeah, we wanted, when you say, why did you start the label? Well, we did radio shows. We did a fanzine. We were both playing music. To us, being in a band, running a record label, doing fanzine, those are all the same thing.
They're all
taking control of the media and turning it back on itself and having fun with it.
I mentioned some of the early artists that came through, and there's tons that have come through K Records. But I think about that time, 1982, and we just had John Doe from X talking about the LA punk scene at that time down in Los Angeles, and then on East Coast for Pitchfork, the Feelies came through, and they were doing more of an indie rock thing on the East Coast. Talk about the concept of what kind of music was the Northwest producing, that K Records. What did you want the music to sound like coming out of the Northwest in 1982?
We were really into weird-ass pop, like the Feelies are a good example. People that were making pop music that wasn't popular, but it was really exciting. So it was punk. There was, the Wipers, of course, were huge to us at that time. And there was also the weird art bands like the Blackouts. Portland was full of weird art bands. So all this, it all came together. It didn't have any one sound. There was a Northwest vibe, perhaps, but it was a lot of freaks and weirdos just doing their own thing.
What was the vibe? And I want to get to that, to the idea that there's sort of this classification of what we know to be Northwest music, rock music, grunge, things like that, which is different. But what was the vibe in the 80s, especially coming out of Olympia as opposed to Seattle?
It was fun. I think people were like, let's do something. Let's go with it. Let's just get a crazy idea and stay up all night and paint something and then maybe even paint your guitar. In fact, paint your guitar to the floor and then you have to play it upside down. Whatever works.
There you go. I don't know how that's
whatever doesn't work.
Yeah, whatever doesn't work.
Whatever doesn't work, you can turn it around and turn it into something that happens.
Do you find yourself, we're talking about the early 80s, do you find that same aesthetic in your life today? I mean, do you find yourself doing things where you're coming up with weird, out there kind of ideas, like painting your guitar to the floor? Is it the same aesthetic that drives you as a musician today?
The record label started, it's only been 35 years, and there's so much to do. And, you get an idea in 1982, and then suddenly in 2002, you realize you've only done one-third of it, and there's so much more to do. So now here it is 15 years after that, and I feel like I'm just getting started. And that's why the album is called This Party Is Just Getting Started.
Just Getting Started. Calvin Johnson, my guest, the legendary DIY owner of K Records out of the Northwest, Olympia, Washington. He is also with his band Selector Dub Narcotic, which just came through Chicago. Let's do this. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back. We'll continue our conversation. Calvin Johnson here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Calvin Johnson, my guest tonight on the show. His band, Selector Dub Narcotic, it just came through Chicago. It's got a new album out as well. Also, the legendary founder of K Records, the DIY champion, really, of independent music, punk music, indie rock, things like that were coming out of Olympia, Washington in the 80s and 90s. You worked with early albums for both Beck and Modest Mouse and bands like that. What we know in the Midwest, especially the uninitiated music fan, is grunge music. We know it to be, if you think about, everyone wanted to be in Seattle in 1991. right? 1990, where you had bands like Mudhoney or Screaming Trees or Pearl Jam or Nirvana. And I guess I ask you, as a guy who was in that area and covered those bands early on, how much does history look at it and tell the right story? Was there truly sort of like this great thing happening in the Northwest with all these grunge bands coming out, or was there more to it?
That's a good question. I want to remember it the way I remember it. When you talk about Mudhoney, that's a fantastic band. They're still playing. I just saw them. I played a show at a festival with them about 2 months ago, and it was awesome. They're so fun. They have always been a fun rock and roll band. They definitely, it was like, hey, something's going on here. Definitely, everyone felt that because they were like a super group. You know, they came out of the ashes of other groups that everyone liked. But there was so much going on besides that. You can point to something like the bands that are known for grunge and what their sound was and what it was. I think it was just one aspect of what was happening then. And there were so many bands that were doing fun things and, you know, Room 9 and Young Fresh Fellows and just all these crazy bands from Seattle. But there was all these other bands that weren't from Seattle. And now let's remember the Melvins. They're from Aberdeen. Screaming Trees. They're from Ellensburg. And Girl Trouble. They're from Tacoma. And I think that you had these bands that grew up outside of any major metropolitan city and had to figure it out for themselves and had to invent their own way. And that's, I think, where the most interesting music came from. And that's why you know, the Melvins and Screaming Trees are still, like, bands that I revere.
Right. Well, Olympia, too, right? The idea that that wasn't Seattle, it was a different scene. Was there any, animosity is not the right word. Was there rivalry between the two cities? The idea that the music scene that was happening where you were at and with K Records versus what was happening in Seattle?
Well, we're just one of many things that's going on in Olympia. Olympia's just always been a hotbed of activity. So you can't say Olympia is any one thing, just like you can't say Seattle is any one thing. But whereas you probably could say that in Ellensburg, the Screaming Trees were were the band. But we had a good relationship because Bruce had moved from Olympia to Seattle, and he started doing his radio show up there, and then a column in the monthly paper, and then it became a record label. So he was a focal point. So we were like best friends, and so we were connected in a lot of ways, and the bands that were really exciting in Seattle at the time, the U-Men, he put out their first record on his label before Bomb Shelter Records before he started the Sub Pop label, and I still think U-Men are like one of the best bands that came out of Seattle in the last 30 years. Yeah, so we definitely had a lot of connections between the two, and there was that period when Beat Happening first started when there was no all ages shows in Seattle, so a lot of Seattle bands like the U-Men, their first two shows outside of Seattle were in Olympia, playing at our places and Green River. A bunch of Seattle bands came down and played in Olympia because there wasn't any place for kids to see them up there.
You know, I think of all the big markets when it comes to American music, and I think of Chicago, and Chicago's very proud of the bands that come from here. I think of New York, of course, Atlanta, L.A., but there's something about Seattle where it seems like Seattle in the Northwest, that there seems to be music in the culture. And I don't mean like an industry like in Nashville, but music in the counterculture, music in the everything about it, where you want to go. If you go to Seattle, you want to go see remnants or memorabilia that was from music that was produced there. What do you think that is? Where does that soul come from the Northwest?
Well, in Portland and Seattle, these other cities I'm talking about, Aberdeen or whatever, the people that are making the music there, they're from there. The people that are making music there, that's where they're from. Now, if you talk about San Francisco, a lot of people, they moved to San Francisco. They moved to New York to become famous, to do something. Whereas these people, they all grew up, you know, that's the Melvins grew up in Grays Harbor County, and that's where they made the music. And they never lived in Seattle. They never lived in Seattle. They lived in Grace. They lived in Aberdeen or Montesano until they moved to California. So it's really it's a native. I think it's a native. The soul that you're talking about comes from that native perspective.
You know, as an owner of a label, or you know, K Records and everything in between, and a musician yourself, and a lot of different bands over the years. How do you balance that? How do you balance being an artist and being a businessman?
I decided that I don't want to be a businessman. That's why I'm out here on tour as a Selectric Dub Narcotic, because I just want to make music. I realized a couple years ago, I'm not getting any younger, so I better go for it. So here I am.
Yeah. I think about K Records, and K Records is will always be, for so many different music lovers, it's a place that is hallowed ground because of all the bands that came through and just the aesthetic that you kind of push forward. But you talk about you don't want to be a businessman, and there's been a lot of press in the last couple of years about some of the early bands. They want some, they feel like you owe money, and there's debts. Mm-hmm. You're selling off some of the property mm-hmm. and things. Is that part of not wanting to be a businessman, the idea that this controversy around K Records
well,
is sort of blown
we
up?
We want people to get to what's due to them, and so we are trying to organize what you might call in the business world liquidating mm-hmm. our assets to try to pay off the people who it, right, the money rightfully belongs to. Yeah, it's never been a fun part of doing it, and so I realized that I should leave that to people who are better at it than me.
35 years. You made that decision a couple years ago. What made you do that? Was it after 30 years of being the guy at K Records, where you just like a light bulb went off, or you're just like,
well, I just felt my the music I wanted to make. I'm working on that Selected Dub Narcotic album with Smoke was just so much fun, and I just realized this is what I really wanted to do all the time. Mm-hmm. I just want to play some fun music, and It's great to go out and everyone's dancing, and it's just really, it's what it's all about.
I can't even imagine what it would be like to run an independent record label at this day and age. And when you're talking about 2017, where the industry has changed, is that kind of in the back of your mind as well, about the idea that the world has changed around music, and it's a more difficult industry to maneuver?
What's beautiful about the industry or the music world right now is that music is so accessible. It's so wonderful. You know, when we did the fanzine or the radio show, it's like we're writing about this music that no one will ever hear. And that's why we turned it into a cassette fanzine, because it's like, well, we're going to put the music on the cassette so they're not only writing about it, they can actually hear what it is. Mm-hmm. And that's not even an issue anymore. You can hear immediately music that people make across the world.
Right.
And it's amazing. It's fantastic. And I think the fact that the streaming technology has allowed people to communicate so directly with each other, it's a beautiful part of making art in the year 2017.
Galvin Johnson in studio. The band Selector Dub Narcotic just came through town. One of the DIY champions, the legend, indie rock royalty, Galvin Johnson. You can see the legend. It's fascinating, too. The legend of K Records is in the documentary, The Shield Around the K. And I remember that back in the day. And it's fun to be able to look it up on YouTube, and there it was from 2000 back in the day. So it's good stuff. Calvin Johnson, I can't thank you enough for coming in tonight.
Yeah,
and,
I appreciate you having me here.
Thank you, Rob. That's right. It's time to play the worst. 312-981-7200 here on the download. Justin Kaufman. And, oh, man, do we have an awesome, awesome panel in studio tonight. All right. Yeah. Might have. Yeah, I don't know what I was doing there. I kind of went over.
Way to set us up for failure. There,
Abby
Justin.
McEnany, good to see you, Abby.
Justin, come on, dog. How are you?
You can't use trumpets to bring in chicken fried steak, man. Like, it's just us.
TJ Jagodowski. TJ, good to see you.
You too, pal.
You guys both, TJ, you officially, Abby, you're just going to try to get in Letters of Santa. Monday to Tuesday, the 20th to 21st coming up here. We had Scott Goldstein on last week talking about the same gig here. Of course, this is the big show at Second City where you improvise for 24 hours. That's coming up here. But there's much more than that. I mean, big stars come out of the woodwork.
Yeah, there's huge. There's musical guests. Jeff Tweedy plays every year, and he'll be back this year. Martha Plimpton's going to come and sing. Jack McBrayer will be there. So friends we don't even know yet are going to be showing up, and it's, you know, it's a couple hours of us knowing what we're doing, and then 20 hours in the middle where it's just a miasmic mess, if I'm using that word right.
That's exactly right.
And, of course, at Second City, and it's the 20th to the 21st, Letters to Santa. It's every year. It's become a tradition here in Chicago. All right, 312-981-7200. We play the worst. This is where we complain about the worst things in society. We got some great prizes, including from Tree Time. This is fun. From Tree Time, we've got pre-lit, a desktop pre-lit, sports-themed artificial tree.
All right. Whoa. That rings in the season.
That
I like that.
Nothing.
Nice.
Sports-themed.
Holidays more than a bull's artificial tree.
A tree with athlete's foot. Perfect, guys. Thanks.
And, of course, you got the Lou Malnati's gift certificate as well. So we got a lot to do tonight, and people are already calling in, texting in, so let's get to it. 312-981-7200. But let's start, as we do every week, with Pete Zimmerman, who kicks us off with the worst. Pete, what do you got for the worst?
You know what's the worst?
What's the worst, Pete?
Well, actually, this is going to be – this is a beef.
Oh, yeah. I love the beefs.
You know how I'm the Downloads Christmas enthusiast?
Yes.
You know, I'm a fan of the season.
Outstanding.
So, I don't know. Are you familiar with this Fitzgerald It's a Wonderful Life pop-up bar that they're doing?
Yes. No. Yes. I saw this.
So they have three dates in December, the 6th, the 13th, and the 20th, and they're changing over this one, their sidebar into it, and It's a Wonderful Life bar, and they're going to be slinging, like, you know, Zuzu's Petal drinks, you know. And and I was like, this is right up my alley. Facebook, interested.
As one does. As one, you're interested.
I mean, you're really going out there, Pete.
Right. So then I see a thing today in the morning saying that they've had a lot of interest on Facebook for this event, so that they are going to only do it by RSVP. And I was like, I'm interested in 900 things that took place tonight.
They took the actual interest from the Facebook page, like they took the, and realized, oh, there's a lot of interest.
Right.
Not realizing that it's fake interest. You're clicking interest a lot.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's a lot of fake interest. Yeah, but I was like, well, at first, I was like, well, they're getting ahead of it. And, you know, so the people show up, there's 900 people in line. But then they say tickets go on sale at noon. Call 312-876-521. They're like the bar line. So it's like one lady is sitting there
Fitzgerald's.
Right, exactly.
When do you want to go?
Yes, exactly.
That's great.
So I, from 12 to like 4. You know, or you hear a ring and then it hangs up on you.
It's like calling the radio station to get you two tickets back in there.
Yes, when I wanted to hear Living After Midnight and Judas Priest on the loop. And then it came up and I was like, yes.
Well, it sounds like. Did you get tickets or no?
No, sold out.
It sounds like not all this interest was fake.
Yeah, right?
It sounds like some of this interest was actual interest.
I was very upset about, like, I mean, I understand, you know, RSVP, but, like, take a couple of days. It's not happening until the 6th. Like, do an Eventbrite or a brown paper tickets or something. Get something.
Right.
Where you're just calling the bar line with, like, you know, some poor woman. Or I think they said it was a woman that was answering the phone. So
Fitzgerald's
like
Connie. I remember when we used to do shows at the Gallery Cabaret in Bucktown, that the people would call. Like, they would do the same thing. They would call to see if they could get tickets. But the bar didn't do it. It was just essentially to show up, and they would call, and you'd get Kenny or one of the guys, hello, I'm in gallery. He'd be like, and you just, I'd be watching out and just listening to him and go, I don't know. It's a,
what
they do? And he goes, he actually said something. I don't know. These guys, I don't know. It's a, some sort of comedy show. It's from Linkin Park. I don't know. And he hung up on him. And I'm like, that's not. I don't know. It's not what that is, but okay.
We used to do the Subterranean over in Bucktown, and the guy walked in like, so where's the show going to be? And the guy pointed to where the pool table still was. It was right there.
Right there.
We have to move the pool table.
That's why improv groups, people don't know that. That's why improv groups are so big. They're 8 or 9 people because you got to move the pool table.
Yeah, it's usually big dudes. That's why there's so many dudes in improv.
Everyone,
you might have to.
You know what? That's the reason
you
so many,
have to break the
so
room
many
down.
Dudes are in improv. They got to, that's exactly.
They got to move the pool table.
You guys know, oh man, you cracked the code. You guys cracked the code.
All right, TJ, kick us off. What do you got for the worst?
Oh, hearing about someone else's dreams. It doesn't. It didn't happen. It didn't happen. It's not interesting. It's barely interesting to you, and you were the only, you know, audience member for it. Someone who wants to tell you about their dreams. That's the worst.
I'm with you, man.
Yeah, didn't happen. I don't care how it makes you feel.
Yeah,
didn't happen.
I just had a terrible dream.
It's not real. I don't care.
Just now I'm really. Oh, and I'm like, well, it's not real. So.
Even if you were in it, you know, like, I don't care. I didn't do that.
I didn't do that.
It doesn't make any sense, and I didn't do that. So, like, however that made you feel about me, not real, because I didn't
real,
do that.
So. Let's separate. I love it.
I barely want to hear about the real stuff that happened to you. Let's not get into the stuff that didn't actually happen to you.
All right, Abby, what do you got for the worst?
The worst thing is that on our way down here tonight, I told TJ about like 3 of my dreams from the last week. And So and he went first. So I guess I just learned a lot. I guess that's pretty bad. I would say in the last 22 minutes, that's probably been the worst
that's
thing.
The worst thing. There you go. I loved it right when you get in the car. TJ, I haven't seen you in a while. Let me tell you about my dreams.
He was like, you know what? It's only like a 17-minute drive. I'm like, you know what? We'll get through three of them. We got a whole ride back. Yeah.
And that's why I don't prep for this, because I know I'll pick Abby up. And something's just going to fall right into my lap.
Something falls right in. 312-981-7200. TJ and Abby in studio tonight. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back, and we will get to the text line. The phones are lighting up. Stay with us. Playing the worst, Abby McEnany, TJ Jagodowski, 312-981-7200. Complaining about the worst things in society for prizes. All right, why don't we get to, you want to get to these guys and see what we can do. Let's go to Rhonda. She'll kick us off tonight. Rhonda, what's the worst, Rhonda?
Well, when you're sitting at work and your building is up for sale and you see the people walking through who are looking to possibly buy it, and you're supposed to be all nice and polite, and once you know it does get sold, you're pretty much out of a job.
Oh, so you're sitting there and other people are walking through and they want you to play the game, even though when it's sold, you're out.
Yep, basically.
Do you do anything to subvert that?
Yeah, can you try and look absolutely indispensable at that point? Like, maybe you come with the building?
I don't know, I guess. Maybe, I don't know.
What's your building going for? I'll buy it and keep you there.
Yeah. You need to find a benefactor. Get one of the
rich
really.
Guys.
All right, well, that is the worst. That's the worst. So I hope it works out for you. Thanks, Rhonda.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye, Rhonda.
Good luck.
She's happy. She's laughing through it.
Well. She's taking it well.
Yeah, I would do like it's like the movie, what was it, Step Brothers with Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly, when they're trying to sell the house and they there's all the stupid stuff they've got going on there.
And this was me. I was like, oh, this is amazing. All the stupidest stuff. I'm like,
it was so
that's
stupid.
A good one, John C. Reilly.
All right. 847, the worst is when you go to donate some money to a homeless person on the street. And they look at you funny and say, I'm not homeless. How often is that really happening?
One time when I first moved here, it was in the first month that I moved here. At home, you know, my hometown wasn't well off, but we just didn't have folks like hanging out asking for coin. And this guy was sitting, on a stoop and he had a coffee cup out. And so I was like, you know what? This guy's not asking. So this is going to be the guy I give the money to. Dropped a bunch of coin into his coffee.
right
into his coffee. I was like, wow, I didn't hear that hit the cup because it hit a bunch of coffee. And he was like, no, oh, no, man. And he dumped his coffee out over his hand to get my coins out from it so he could go buy a new coffee.
What do you do at that point?
I don't know. I just said, sorry, man. I kept on walking. I didn't really break stride. I just kind of caught it over my shoulder.
Lesson learned.
My old stage manager, when I was... one of my stage managers at Second City, he was kind of a ruffled guy, and he'd kind of like, he smoked, and then it was winter, and he had kind of the schlubby hat on, and he kind of rocked a little bit, and he got to the van, and he goes, some guy just gave me $1. we howled. I mean, there are like 8 of us in that van, and
you know where you're at in life when someone gives you $1.
We screamed all the way up to the Upper Peninsula. I mean, we were just dying. It was the best.
Your next thought should be, I'm on to something.
Yeah, right? I think there's a lot of people out there that are doing that.
I mean, we didn't make any money. That's actually kind of a good gig.
All right, 708 says the worst, along the lines of what TJ was talking about, listening to someone's relationship problems.
Mm-hmm. At least they're real, you know. Yeah. I hear you. Yeah,
I mean, I get. It depends on the person, I guess.
Yeah,
like, if you're like, "How's it going?" Well, I gotta tell you, last night was a tough night.
Yeah.
Then you're like, "All right, I didn't really want
to." I wanted to find.
Yeah, but
I wanted to find fine. You fine? Good.
Fine.
Just say fair to Midland. We both say fair. It. We can move on. Let's just be honest. You know, not great.
I'll even take a not great.
Yeah.
As long as you don't explain.
Yeah.
Not great. Oh, great. Okay. Well.
Not great. No follow-up.
Yeah. 708 says the worst is not being able to get change for a large bill at a major store.
Boo. Hoo. For a large bill.
Man,
Papa Monopoly bring his 10G bill in there? His 7P Chase $10,000 bill?
I got to say, I kind of side with 708 a little bit because I get clammy and sweaty when I have a $50 bill. And I gotta change it for something that's like maybe $10 or something. Like you buy something at $9. I'm like, this is not gonna work out. These people are gonna be like, what do you have? This? Why do you have? We don't have. We can't do this. I gotta call a manager.
Buy more.
That's what I find myself going. Is there? I get a bigger bag of Doritos. Like, what do I do to make this work?
Well, the way the guy said, or the 708 said it, was that he just had 100 and he just walked into it at Macy's. Is like, can I change this? I mean, like, he didn't buy anything. Right. He was like, hey man, can you change 100?
Right. All right, we keep going. The worst is 773 going crazy here. The worst is Cubs pitcher John Lackey.
Oh,
big horse tooth, horse faced. Put a bag over his head, set him pack, and call it a day.
Wow. There's a lot. There's a lot you can go at with his personality. That dude's just all over his face. Like, Lackey's a complainer.
Yeah.
Lackey's problem is his face looks like his attitude. It was the same problem with Cutler.
Yeah, right.
Cutler's
right.
face looked like his attitude,
right.
you know?
Some athletes have that. Yeah. Right. Some people have that.
Yes.
Right. I would just classify athletes. A lot of people I know. Family members have that. All right. 815 says the worst is when your husband gives you his man cold. Then insists he was way sicker when he had it.
Oh.
Oh, well, you just, you know, I was really sick.
Do you guys ever think that, like, oh, that person says they're really hurt. Like, they whacked their elbow or something. They said they're really hurt. And, like, I wish I could know exactly. I want that exact amount of pain and see how I react to it, whether I'd be more hurt or less hurt.
Like, and get it only be that hurt for like 20 seconds, but like know what the appropriate reaction should
exactly.
be.
Exactly. Yeah. Like,
that would be amazing.
Yeah. If I was as sick as you, would I be acting as like whiny as you are? I would like to know.
Like
that.
A real life Mel Gibson What Women Want movie. You know, like, but around pain.
Whenever, like growing up, whenever my dad got sick, he'd go, it's the big one, Elizabeth. It's the big one. Like, he was just the worst. And then he'd be like, I'm on my deathbed. It's like, oh, my God, I'll get you a Kleenex. I mean, it was just a
Someday, white. Pop. Someday.
Someday, Pop. Someday. TJ Jagodowski, Abby McEnany in studio, 312-981-7200. Let's do this. We'll take a break. Then we'll get the news with Rob, and then we'll come back and we'll continue with the worst. We got good stuff. Stay with us.
It's going down, y'all.
Thanks, Rob. We're playing the worst here. 312-981-7200. Abby McEnany and TJ Jagodowski in studio tonight. We're having some fun. Letters to Santa coming up on Monday, the 20th through Tuesday, the 21st. 24-hour improv.
A-thon. 5 p.m. to 5 p.m. It might officially be called The Second City That Never Sleeps if they're looking for it online or whatever. Yeah, but 5 p.m. Monday to 5 p.m. Tuesday.
And it's a collection of some of the best performers in Chicago, not just improvisers, musicians like Jeff Tweedy, actors like Martha Plimpton, all coming together for good cause, donating to charity for
Christmas
season.
Raising some dough for Letters to Santa, and then Heather Winna and Steve Albini and Jeff Tweedy and Tim Midget and some other folks deliver those gifts on Christmas morning to needy folks. And sometimes, like, 10 to 15 grand in cash, literal cash and prizes.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah, she picks only a certain amount of letters, so maybe 10 or a dozen letters. And the last few years, we've raised six figures. And sometimes
that's
awesome. Matched
that's,
by
that's,
Second
a lot.
City.
That says a lot, not just for Second City, but the improv community coming together and making this a must-attend event.
Everybody at their best. You feel kind of good about it all.
All right, there we go. All right, 312-981-7200. Let's see what we got lined up. 219 says the worst is the sound of your hubcap scraping the curb when you're parallel parking.
Yeah,
Peggy.
I hear you. Yeah.
Are you a big parallel parker, Abby?
I've never had a license, so no.
But if she were, you know it'd be parallel. Hey, man, if I ever get into parking, you know it's going to be parallel. Yeah. You know it is. Perpendicular parking for chumps.
Yeah. For someone who has been a passenger your entire life.
Oh, I've heard it. Oh, yeah, I've heard it. And I'm closer to the curb.
But do you feel like, as a passenger who's never had a license so you don't drive, do you feel like you got it down, though?
Do I feel I have what?
Driving down. Are you I know what's up.
No, I mean, I took driver's training when I was 18 in San Francisco, and I could go up and down hills in a stick shift car. And so just highways freaked me out, man. Highways
but do you
freaked
feel like,
me out. So, yeah, I could drive you. Look, Justin, right, I could drive you to a hospital in a stick shift car. Is that what you're asking?
That's
baby, I got you. Just not on a highway.
Take this, Kennedy. No,
man, I'm going local.
Yeah. And if you need to go to the hospital, you want to be taking the country roads there.
Some of the alternate routes, right?
Yeah, no merging for this old lady.
312 says, the worst is when you walk into the garbage chute area on your floor, condo, I'm assuming, and step into the sticky gunk that a clueless, inconsiderate slob left behind with no thought to clean it up.
Sure.
Agreed.
And that might not be, that might not just be one person. That could be that accumulated, that accumulated gunk, the gunk of ages.
The gunk of ages.
And if it's a condo, that's not cleaned up on the reg.
Mystery H3O.
Mystery what?
Mystery moisture. You don't know what's conglomerated there.
But to be fair, as someone who had the garbage chute when I had a condo on the other side of the hallway,
uh-huh.
and I had to carry it down there, and you do everything you possibly can not to have leak on the carpet mm-hmm. and everything, and you'd be like, maybe you double fist in, and you're just like, and you get there. When that chute opens up with your elbow and you shove that bag down, uh-huh. you're done.
Go time.
You're not cleaning up afterwards. You're like, that's it. I got here. I did my job.
I love you, like, everything that you could do, but, like, so that happens to you once, then you know better packing next time, Justin.
Right,
you didn't do everything you
could
do.
I did everything in my power.
Kaufman.
I did it. I put it down the chute, and then I went, whew, and I went back, and I felt confident.
And then you repeated that for the next 4 years.
I did my errands. I'm not changing. 630 says the worst is walking around for hours and noticing you're not wearing your Fitbit.
Oh, agreed.
Fitbit worsts. This is going to be our spinoff. That's the Wednesday night show.
Because it doesn't count. It doesn't count unless it went on your Fitbit. It's like you never really walked anywhere, man. If you can't prove it by your Fitbit, you didn't really get the exercise.
What do you do in that situation? Because I guess you're following the data. So if you didn't do that, do you go walk again?
Yeah, just assume you went 3 miles.
Can you manually do that on a Fitbit? Like say, hey, I did 3 miles, deal with it.
Attached to a dog. Attach to a dog and put him in the yard for 2 hours.
Or go to the drive up to the forest preserve.
Yeah.
Just right. after 3 hours,
come
do
back.
The old dog whistle.
Right. Attach it to a bird.
Attach it to a bird.
Thousands of miles by summertime.
The Fitbit on a bird.
309 says, the worst is your coworker throwing up in the cubicle next to you.
Sure.
Oh, gosh.
That's
sure.
a leader. That's a leaderboard
that
right
is.
There. There's Where? Nothing worse. That's a literal worst.
That is.
You does that person work over at Joey's Vomitorium? Maybe. He's just doing business, baby. It's business.
That's every day.
And the sound
and business
alone.
Is good.
The sound alone, but then the you're done with the sound, you're like, that was gross. And you're like,
and then you're like,
oh,
here comes.
Seriously
here
sick?
Come.
Are
here come
sick?
To smell.
But then the smell.
The smell. Mm-hmm. I mean, is this contagious?
And that stuff doesn't go away. I mean, that lingers whether or not you, like, you know.
Yeah. Is
I
this going to be a chunk situation from Goonies where everyone starts throwing up?
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Stand by me?
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Blueberry
pie
deal?
Eating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a lot going on there. All right, let's go. Kathy. Kathy, what's the worst, Kathy?
Well, I want to say the worst for me is having seven teeth extracted, getting dentures the same day, and having the floor of my mouth operated on, and having to walk around with a full set of dentures and trying to talk to people, trying to eat, and being as normal can be.
Kathy, I'm hoping that this story is from 10, 15, 20, 25 years ago and not just right now.
Not right now.
Oh, Kathy!
Kathy!
Right now. I don't have them in now, so excuse me if I sound funny, but they're horrid. I feel like I have a sock in my mouth all day long.
Hey, we'll give you that Malnati's gift certificate up. I can hear you crunch some ice right now, Kath.
Kathy, that just sounds so painful. Hang in there, girl.
Yeah.
Oh, I have no choice.
Yeah,
that's
I hear
right.
you.
That's
right?
Right.
Everything I eat is either parade or it's pudding or baby food. Or
it's terrible.
It stinks.
Well, yeah. Take it slow and soft, Kathy.
Thanks, Kathy. Thank you. Thank you very much. Slow and soft. I guess that's
I
the
guess,
best.
You know?
That was my friend's nickname in college.
Was it your friend's nickname, Abby?
Come on.
Hey, man, I was
the worst nicknames in college.
I was in college for 6 years. I got a lot of those. I'll tell you that.
815 says, I'm a huge Star Wars fan. When episode 7 came out, saw it as soon as possible. The first Saturday was in theaters. Before the movie started, the guy behind me says, hey, this movie's great. I saw it yesterday. Can't believe Han Solo died.
And now someone else has just had this same experience as
the
815. The
one from 4 years ago? Darn it!
Guy's got it in his hand. I was just popping into the DVD player, listening to the radio.
I've complained about this on the show before. The worst is that specific movie, the one with the guy from Girls.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That one, that's coming up the sequel. Disney had a relationship with maybe with Stars or one of the channels they don't get, and that's all you could get it. And so if I wanted to go just to the on-demand section on Comcast and just pay $5.99 to watch a movie, that movie's not available.
Honest to God.
Yeah, and they'll have it on there and say, buy. It's $27.99 if you want to buy it.
No.
You can't rent it. If you could get it if you had this package, they just start getting funny.
Well, it was also just Star Wars again, right?
It was just Star Wars.
You can just watch Star Wars.
But I was like, I wanted to get it because I was on this kick where I watched all of the Star Wars with my son. And I was got to that final one, and we'll do this before the Rogue One came out. And then, they did this. And they still do. I checked it in the summer. Same thing. So it's just like the way Disney works with their movies.
How does it hold up for a kid? Like, is it as magical, those early ones? Like, do they look kind of... Because special effects-wise, they're going to look different. Does it hold up story-wise and stuff for him? Like,
I think it's probably more nostalgic for us because you get to see Han Solo and you get to see Carrie Fisher playing Princess Leia. And this next one's going to have Mark Hamill and Skywalker.
Yeah.
I just call him Skywalker. I don't know. Luke's for the... I'm so into Star Wars. It's just Skywalker.
Mister,
my dad was Mr. Skywalker. Please, call me Luke.
Actually, so I guess...
Is Juan going to be on there?
Exactly. So I don't know. I guess it holds up. It was a good story. Yeah, you didn't see it, I guess.
No.
No, I'm sorry. I ruined it for you. Well, now you don't have to see it. That's pretty much the whole thing. There's some really great aerial stuff going on there.
Okay,
some
great.
Planes,
I'll check it out.
Planes and stuff like that.
Planes.
DJ
love
Jagodowski.
Planes.
Abby McEnany. 312-981-7200. We'll come back. We'll continue the worst and, of course, crown our winners. Stay with us.
It's going down, y'all. Come the worst, my people come first. You know the worst come the
worst. Come the worst. It's the worst. 312-981-7200. TJ Jagodowski, Abby McEnany in studio. Second City Never Sleeps, 20th, 21st, the 24-hour improv-a-thon, which is coming up. It's not just improv. There's music. There's comedy. Starts at 5 o'clock, ends at 5 the next day.
Correct. Yep.
I nailed it.
Yeah, you did.
I did.
Yeah, you did.
That was all off memory.
And if you get off work 2-3 in the morning, or you don't have a quiet place to sit and boo, feel free to come by at 4 a.m.
You'll have a lot of reasons to. Yeah. You'll come by it honestly.
We'll give you some opportunities for sure.
All right, you guys ready?
Yeah.
All right, here we go. The worst is eating out of a big bag of potato chips, only to realize a mouse had made a hole in the side and left presents inside.
What kind of presents? Maybe I'm missing that. That sounds wonderful. Some magical mouse gave you presents? Tiny little wrapped packages?
Mouse presents. Just poorly wrapped.
Stupid mice, tiny hands.
Man, what a waste of tape.
630 says the worst is when you take your car in to get the brakes checked and part of your brake falls off. Well, your car's in the mechanic's parking lot. Oof.
It's bad, but it's almost opportune. That's where you want it to happen.
Yeah, right.
You know,
there's a silver lining.
And you already know that that it's a real problem. You don't, if you're like me and the mechanic comes back and goes, there's a brake problem. Is there?
Yeah, exactly.
Or
right.
Or is it an expensive problem?
Yeah.
Right.
Or are you just trying to take some more money out of my pocket?
Right.
If I'm having something taken care of, it's been a problem for a long time.
Exactly. 847 says the worst is when your mother-in-law volunteers to babysit your kids and you come home to find she's rearranged all your furniture. What?
That is...
Winner.
Happened to my mom, my sisters, and I still laugh about it.
That is...
Wow. That's a good one.
That is horrible.
Right?
Beefy. Yeah. Beefy. Beefy grandmama there or whatever.
God, she could have been one of the original men in improv. She's moving stuff around.
Right. She's moving stuff around, right.
She and a four-year-old moved a sectional to the other side of the room.
Little Nikki. Nikki, grab that side. Right. I'm going to take this over here.
Nikki, you can do it.
773, the worst is having a house contract and the potential buyer pulls out with no explanation. Yeah,
that's not good.
630, the worst is sitting at a hot slot machine.
Oh.
That's a great name. Speaking of an improv. Improv
last
scene.
Time I was hot here, someone
machine.
Had a hot slot machine story.
Hot slot machine that you want to stay on at the casino.
Yes.
And the 50-year oldish couple sits on each side of you and continually crosstalks with you cutesy baby talk.
They're trying to get you off that machine. They're working off the machine.
Cutesy baby.
We put a quarter in the money.
Oh, I would lose that.
A bunch of cherries.
At least they're talking. The even worse than that is when they just stare and watch you play.
I hate that.
That's awful.
I was just in Vegas somebody was like, oh, can you explain it to me? I'm like, you're ruining my juju.
No, I cannot.
No. 779 Larry. Larry says the worst is when I order an Uber and the driver accepts the ride, then cancels because I'm 8 minutes away. Uber's hard to come by out here. I don't know where out here is.
I don't either. He's 8 minutes from something.
When I was at a wedding, I told the story in the air, and a taxi driver from out in the Long Grove area got mad at me for even using the rideshare service. Yeah, I got a bunch of texts that got mad at me, like, hey, I could have got you in 10 minutes. But we did Uber. It was like a Saturday night at like maybe 12, 12:30. I was at a house. It was raining.
Yeah.
We put Uber in like 1 hour.
Whoa. Guy had like, some stops to make.
Yeah, I was like, well, then, okay.
Hey, man, I'm still sleeping. I'll be up in about a half an hour. Quick shower.
Right.
I'm not that far away. I'm just not interested.
Good to see that Lyft and Uber really penetrated the northern suburbs, right?
Yeah. I'm finishing my hot pocket. Yeah. I'll be there as soon as I can.
I'm right near you.
My laundry's almost done with my only pair of pants. I'll be there as soon as they dry.
I'm on my shift's about to start. All right, let's go to Mark. Mark, what's the worst, Mark?
Okay, the worst is you're in college. You come home. Mm-hmm. You have to use the bathroom. Mm-hmm. You walk in and you find your roommate is passed out, straddling the toilet after an evening of drinking a bit too much.
Is this Tommy, my roommate? No.
Tommy.
No.
Wasn't me.
No, it isn't.
It seems like it seems like a me thing.
No, well, we've talked before, but I'm not Tommy.
Okay.
So, roommate then tries to pick you up. And you're too big to move. So roommate, in an hour of need, has to straddle you while accomplishing the task, number two.
That's quite a college experience.
Let me add a note.
All right.
I'm the one who was passed out.
Okay, there we go.
That's what you're looking for. Thanks, Mark.
You started as the roommate.
Yeah.
No, you started as the one coming on the roommate, and then you ended up as the one straddling the toilet.
First to third I like it.
I am the one who, as I told him, you could have whatever. I would not have known, so it was okay.
All right, thanks, Mark. Thanks for that.
If you were too big to move, I know a mother-in-law who could have taken care of that. No problem.
All right, Ed, what's the worst, Ed?
Yes, Ed and Joliet.
Hey, all right. How you doing, buddy?
Yeah, the worst is when you have a dinner party for 8, and the timer goes off that your roast is done. And you find out the oven hasn't been turned on.
I once made a pizza. It was a really great pizza. It was a frozen pizza. And what I made the mistake, my wife had put a candle on the oven.
Oh,
yeah.
And to like, you know, it's just for decoration. And I didn't move it. Uh-huh. And so the candle melted down and went into the back of the oven. So every time you turn the oven on, it smelled like candle in the house. I thought it was really nice. I emailed GE.
I think at that point in the night, Ed, you start selling them on the idea of roast tartare.
Yeah. There you go.
There you go. Thanks, Ed. Thanks for the call, bud. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
All right, 312-981-7200. I think we're pretty much ready to rock. We got our three. 708 says the worst is dry, itchy skin.
Sure.
Yeah.
All right, what do you guys have before we go?
Oh,
CJ, what do you got for
that? I thought the worst, for a long time, I thought the worst was patchouli, that I hated patchouli.
Yeah.
And then we recently, Beth and I, we got married not too long ago, we received incense, patchouli, and I smelled it, and I realized, oh, I don't mind patchouli. I don't like hippies. I don't like the smell of hippies. Like old hair and feet, dirty
you had
feet.
All that
what,
to the
yeah,
patchouli.
I thought that was what patchouli was.
Oh, no, man.
Yeah, right. It's not.
All right, Abby, what do you got?
This is hypothetical. It's like if two people get married and they're in their 70s and one has two kids and one has three kids and they're all like in their 40s, maybe two in their 50s and they have kids and they want to, like these two 70-some-year-olds want to create a blended family and everybody's already grown up. You know what? What is happening? This is just too late, man.
Hypothetically.
Yeah, it's all hypothetical. We're not in middle school. It is... it is horrible. The worst. It's the hypothetically worst. The worst.
Hypothetically the worst. All right. All right. We got our winners. We got them. All right. Here for a certificate For a desktop pre-lit sports theme artificial tree, come by Tree Time on Pepper Road in Lake Barrington to pick out the team theme of your choice while supplies last. And then we also have a Lou Malnati's gift certificate. Lou Malnati's is home of Chicago's best deep dish pizza. Find one of their 40-plus Chicagoland locations or order online at loumalnati's.com. All right, so for third place, who's going to get a pizza? 309, the worst is when your coworker's throwing up in the cubicle next to you. We just had to go with so much going on there.
I mean, give the person who's not going to want to eat for 2 days a pizza. I think that's a good
Yeah, right. And then 815 is also going to get a pizza. Huge Star Wars fan. When episode 7 came out, someone in the audience spoiled the movie right at the top. And then I left this part out. It was the first time I've seen people throw popcorn. So it wasn't just to him. The whole theater.
The whole giant.
And that's the Saturday? That's a full theater?
That guy went there to do that.
Yeah, that's a terrible thing.
He went there to do that.
There's got to be a law.
That guy's going to be flying Han Solo for the rest of his movie-going career.
All right, first place tonight, you're going to get a trip. Go up to Lake Barrington to the Tree Time on Pepper Road to get the artificial tree. It's going to be 847. The worst is your mother-in-law volunteers to babysit your kids, and you come home to find she's rearranged all your furniture.
That is unbelievable.
That's a big pile of feng shui right there.
That is unbelievable.
Man.
Abby, TJ, great to have you guys.
Great to see you, pal.
Both out at the Second City Never Sleeps this Monday and Tuesday, the 20th and 21st, 5 p.m. to 5 p.m. All the donations, the proceedings go to charity, to Letters to Santa. Guys, great to see you.
You too, pal. Always a good time.